mein auf den Supercast.
Well, welcome to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast, episode 416. I'm Adam, and here's Debbie Melrose.
Hello.
And, very rarely, Ben Shoveler.
No, you should really should have introduced the other people first. I am but a byproduct of this.
No, you're the saviour of the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast. That's what she said, anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, anyway, right here, welcome. We have an audience who have actually turned up to see someone else.
A live audience. Hello, audience.
Hello, audience. And,
hello, Mum.
We have a fancy thing called a radio mic, which means that Ben can go around and interview people in our audience. Is this enough as an audience, or is it just people who turned up? I don't know what you...
I think they're waiting for the next person, aren't they?
I'd say it's a splattering.
Yes. Well, we're here at FantasyCon, where we're... I haven't really got time to do this podcast, to be fair. I'm supposed to be around running the thing. We've got Billy Kurt Bright, who's sat there waiting for his correctly sized T-shirt. We've got the Staggering Stories team, which Ben and go and
there they go.
Scare away.
Staggering Stories.
In
hey, Ab.
We've got Hadley.
Butcher.
Hello, Hadley.
Alan.
We've got VJ. Hello, VJ. Hello.
Hello,
God, this
right,
is
then.
Really weird seeing people.
Yes, it is weird. Yeah. So, Kirby, have you seen anything on the internet regarding the event?
Kirby?
He's gone to fall asleep. Is the internet connection gone?
Mary?
Oh, well, we'll just do... Well, that's not true.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
Oh, we've got more audiences. There's Josh Erdwin on
Kirby?
In a minute. Ah, okay.
Kirby! Okay, have you seen anything on the internet about what we've been up to?
It's probably because I didn't introduce him. That's probably why he's not speaking.
Right,
it's not good, is it? All right, then. So, Instagram. You've been interviewing some people.
Yes, I have been interviewing people. Many famous people who are more famous than me, even though I share a poster with them.
Yes, you do. But nobody can recognise you because you look like a Jedi.
That's not been good. I looked around with a big lightsaber across my face, then people might have realised
it was.
Well,
we've deliberately moved them into the other room. So have you enjoyed any of them, as in interview-wise?
No, they've all been horrible.
Oh, they are. Dear.
I've not enjoyed any of it.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, they've you know, they take me around the back and beat me our interview.
I don't blame them for that. I think that's, thumbs up from Alan T. Butcher in the audience there.
But it's obviously been great. I mean, yesterday was a wonderful day.
Very hot, though.
It was very hot
very
indeed,
hot,
sir.
Yes,
we had a nice chat with Colin Baker. A lovely chat with Christopher Ryan. Yes. And then I had to go home.
Yeah, but you have a chance to chat with them again today.
Yes, that's right. Later on, we've got a Doctor Who panel coming up later.
Yes, fantastic. And it's all been recorded, so it'll be on the show at some point.
Oh,
is
it?
Yes.
Oh, you,
yes, you didn't know that, did I?
No, you didn't.
Did you, I should say.
Oh, I'll have to put in a different invoice.
Yes. Debbie, you finally got away from the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast desk.
That's
your time. Go back.
Thank you. Bye. Yes. No, I've been at the desk talking to everybody about the podcast. Also talking to people about the genesis of the this convention as well. And
I thought that was a Doctor Who story for a minute.
We've been talking about quite a few episodes. Obviously, we're doing Megalos next week, so quite a few people have been interested in that.
And we have the viewing tent, which has been showing full
circle.
The viewing tent
has been great. Everybody's really responded.
We have other stories, but nobody's attending to them, so it just seems to play.
Everybody's loving it.
Roy.
Okay. Okay.
What a shame this isn't on video. That was brilliant.
An ambient microphone in a very enigmatic way. Bear in mind, audience, this is an audio presentation, so I have to describe these.
He came on stage like an elephant doesn't.
It's just the way his command thing is flaking off the back of his shirt as well. It's quite amusing.
It was like Tinkerbell.
Yeah. It's good to be just doing this because obviously we sign in like Mary and Kirby haven't basically to conventions in America all the time. So we're always sort of helping out and being in rooms and panels.
Have you been hobnobbing with any of our celebrity guests? It wouldn't be like you not to hobnob.
Well, exactly. I mean, John Leeson's very, very curious about why K9's not working. So, we're trying to get some batteries for him. But other than that, everyone's been really nice. And everyone stopped by the table just to ask about us more than anything and just to see how you're doing.
They shrugged their shoulders and walked away.
Pretty much.
Roy's coming back over. No, he's not. Sorry.
Everybody's been terrific. The response has been fantastic, and also online, the response has been fantastic. So obviously, this is the first time we've done it. No, obviously, we were thinking maybe one room in a hotel, doing a little Doctor Who convention, and to be this big, I had to read
on the internet to find out if it was any good. That's terrible.
And what did you find out?
No, it's been all right. Right, I'd like to thank you guys for coming. Isla's in the audience. Hello, Isla.
Hi, Isla.
She's famous.
Yes, she is famous, isn't she? Yeah, well.
For those who don't know, we do a podcast. That's an online radio show that is recorded so you can listen to it at any time you like. We've got 415 others of these, so you can catch up at any time. It'll take about 9 years to actually catch up because we've been doing them that long.
Kirby's back
and
on.
Sometimes the reception's not that good. You have to come from Australia just to actually meet us to actually hear what we're talking about. Hey,
don't you, Billy? Yeah. All the way from Australia.
Long-term listener. First-time caller.
And look how disappointed he looks. So. Yeah. Never mind. Right then, Ben, do you find we should go off and talk to some people in the auditorium? Sorry, I know you wanted to sit down.
Yeah. Okay, I'll take my...
I reckon we should pick on the people in the... Oh, the head of Pertwee's here. Oh, we've got to get a picture of that.
Got to get the picture of the head of Pertwee. Hang on.
Hello, head of Pertwee.
Not now, Debbie.
Oh, hold on.
You can go.
I can hear an American.
Oh.
I can hear an American.
Hear an American?
Hello, head of Pertwee.
Are we getting interference?
No.
Kirby and Mary, are you there?
I'm here.
Hooray.
Mary, you there?
I'm hanging in. Hello, head of Pertwee.
Hey, right then. So, while you're there, have you heard anything positive about the convention while your social media...
I'm going to sit down again.
Oh, no, go back then.
Go back.
I'm going to sit down.
I read a lot of positive stuff last night.
You saw some stuff last night?
You saw some stuff last night, yes. Anything good?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Love one word answers.
Jolly good. Yeah, okay.
I'll translate.
And I love the pictures I've seen. I like the picture of Valele being photobombed by Colin.
Cool. Oh, I haven't seen that one.
I haven't seen that one, no.
You sure you're looking... Why am I looking at the speaker?
Ben is currently interviewing the speaker.
So, would you like to hear what the Staggering Stories team want to say? Yes, they do. Right, go on then, Ben. Careful. He's got a bad hip, he says. He jumps off the stage. Oh, they look really nervous now. Even the head of Pertwee is looking particularly
I do need some steps.
It's good to see the head of Pertwee at last.
Hi, Pertwee.
This is a radio show.
It's like he's died or something, isn't it?
In case you didn't know, it's a Staggering Stories podcast. It's a podcast. They've been running longer than us, you know.
Have they?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't run anymore. I've got a bad hip.
Yeah.
So, how long have you been going for?
12 years now.
12 years. And why did you start a podcast? I've asked him that so many times.
Be interesting, it's the same answer.
I don't know.
Hey, it's the same answer.
Yeah. We were pushed into it by Galashot. I don't think we have a...
Oh, hold on, I'll do my Jeremy Kyle thing, and I'll walk down here.
The Jeremy Kyle thing. Hobbling.
We're within reason, love.
Films, you know.
Oh, we've lost some audience.
Actually, the podcast grew out of conversations we would have in the kitchen at home. It's just he brought microphones one time.
Oh, yeah. Well, from Applin's.
Yeah, that's how it started.
That's pretty much how we did, really, isn't it? Yeah, we all just sit and chat.
No, I used to record on a video recorder and just take the audio off.
You did? Yeah. You used to record with your...
I remember that.
Yeah. Blooming heck.
Where did that come from? Oh, it was Kirby. Yeah,
God!
I said, I remember when you did the video recorder thing.
Yeah, it worked.
Well, because it was you and Alicia to start with, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And then we met at Southampton Football Club, and then you wrote me on in it for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, you didn't have to do it, but I mean, yeah.
Well, I stopped.
You thought you were going to get paid, didn't you, at some point?
I know I didn't have to do it, so
yeah,
I stopped.
Yeah, you stopped because you got a job, didn't you, at some point?
I don't think things like that happen very often.
It's either that or because we moved to a day that you can be bothered to...
That was it. No, yeah. You moved it. Yes, and then so I left, and then all these internet people turned up.
Yeah.
After I'd left you with a whole load of catchphrases.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
Well, it was actually.
Yeah.
Yes, but it was fun while you were on, Ben. It's not fun anymore.
Was.
I have to put up with Kirby.
It was really good to start.
Money joking, Kirby.
By the looks of it.
just me and you sitting there chatting before these other imposters came along and started stealing my thunder.
Yeah, and nicking your catchphrases. Yeah. So, yeah, look at whoever's with blank faces out there. It's a labour of love doing a podcast, isn't it? Yeah, so it's one of those things you think, oh, God, I've got to do the podcast in a minute. Then you sit down and do it, and you have a couple of hours of really good fun chatting with your friends about your favourite subjects. And then you think, oh, good, that's out of the way. Right, I've got to do some proper stuff now.
Oh, that's how you feel about it, is it? Yeah. All right, okay.
Yeah. It is. It's kind of like, oh, I've got to get ready for the podcast. Yeah, you're talking to my friends, having a good time. And then it's like back to the reality. We're just for a couple of hours a week just to chill out, chat with people.
We're all
bicker with people. Yeah.
And it's difficult for Kirby and Mary, who come in via Skype over the pond. Isn't it, Kirby and Mary?
Mary's gone.
Oh, what's difficult? Mary.
Oh, Mary.
She's very contrary.
What's difficult?
Well, I've come down here.
What's difficult?
Shush. I've come down here to talk to Billy.
Carry on, Kirby.
What did you say? What did you want to know was difficult?
Well, how do you feel when the podcast is due to be recorded? Are you sort of raring to go? Are you thinking, oh, God, it's another
Absolutely.
Podcast?
Absolutely.
Oh, God.
It was a silly question.
Well, Ben is now sat next to Billy Kirkbright.
Hey, I can hear you better now.
Good.
So, obviously we've got our American friends via the internet. Now, you've come from where?
Well, originally Lancashire, but I live in Australia. I've come across to meet you lovely people. And
do apologise.
Yeah. it's like being on another planet. I mean, other side of the world, obviously, but this is quite surreal for me.
I mean, I can tell that you've been in Australia for years, because you've really gained the accent, mate.
No, well, you know, it's more real accent.
Well, is it 25 years or something you've been in Australia and you've still got Lancashire accent?
41 years.
41? Oh, my goodness.
I'm just a stubborn Brit. So it's not going to move.
Right, oh, thanks, Billy. We were thinking of getting some celebrity guests up, but unfortunately they're very busy and they need to remain very busy. So, but they are here. And
we do have them, Kirby. We really do have celebrities in the building.
And they're all fab. And you will hear them, because I will be speaking to them at some point.
Good.
Good,
okay,
yes.
But not today. So, right. Any more things from the audience, Ben? We've got some people here probably waiting for the next gig.
I think they're waiting.
I've got Doctor Who fan up in the corner there, who's rare.
Isla's got a question.
Oh, go on up. Question, go for it. Go on.
I'll walk down the front.
Oh, dear. What is it?
So we can hear about the con from a child's aspect.
What's your name? Where'd you come from? And who's your mum?
I love you, mummy.
Is that all you were going to say?
That's a very good question.
So how are you enjoying the podcast, the convention?
Great.
Yeah?
So what's your favourite thing, Ben? I've heard you've been scared a few times.
What do you mean?
No. She's challenged the Flash twice to chess and won.
Both
so
times.
Yeah, very proud. Very proud.
She won against the Flash?
She won against the Flash.
Was it a quick game?
Yeah, no. Yeah, playing chess. Yeah, he tried to cheat.
He didn't try to cheat.
Oh, I was stand corrected. I do apologise.
You didn't try to cheat. You just cheated.
No, he didn't.
He did.
Not you.
I was going to say, I was looking in your eyes. I was thinking, you couldn't cheat.
Cheat, he did.
How did he cheat?
He moved his bishop four spaces.
The old bishop four spaces move.
Yeah.
Cheat.
The amount of time.
I have to say, as a very important thing that hasn't been announced so far at this event, there's an ice cream van outside.
I have said that.
There you are.
Yes, I have.
Well, I didn't hear it. Obviously, it wasn't loud
two
enough.
Two questions.
I said.
Two ice cream vans. There's two ice cream vans outside.
Yeah,
that's even
earlier,
better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? My God.
I was waiting for an ice cream van for hours, and then two have turned up at the same time.
Yes, I will buy you an ice cream.
I wish I could have one. I'm going to say that on our lovely stage here,
we're
have
so professional.
Passes and a lovely TARDIS, which Roy couldn't resist to materialise on our stage. I tried to do an entry yesterday.
There's a cyber rat here as well, Kirby. You'll love it.
Well, I tried to do an entry yesterday.
Oh, I want to see it. Take a picture.
You can see it in the pictures, okay?
No, I want to see it. Someone take a picture.
I could
do a live video. The trouble is the bandwidth is a bit awkward. But yeah, I wanted to do a big entrance yesterday during the cosplay competition, and it was locked, so that was a bit embarrassing.
So you got stuck on the inside.
In fact, we could have done that big entry today, couldn't we? But
Has anyone ever wondered what the inside of the TARDIS actually looks like, by the way?
I've seen the wallpaper.
Colin Baker told me what it smelt like. And I'm not going to say on a family show.
All I've got to say is that someone... Does this one open as well? Might do. Can you see the wallpaper?
Well,
very
on an
floral.
Audio presentation, I'd say probably not. No,
no, I'll take a picture for
you, Kirby. It's all roundels, isn't it?
Thank you.
Yeah. it's a beautiful rose pattern, pink roses on a light blue wallpaper.
Well, we can change that, can't we, Roy?
I should think that's...
Oh, he's got the back panel next year, but we're going to paint Randall's on it, aren't you?
I think it's probably William Hartnell, actually. I think
no, I would say I'd like to talk about... talk about our guests, how lovely
very
they are.
Very cool TARDIS.
John Bimman is... they were really nice guests. I'm so delighted, because you don't know what people are going to be like until you actually meet them. You just sort of hire them along. And they're all really nice, engaging people. Christopher Ryan is a delight. Mm-hmm. He's so caring. He's always, I hope everything's all right. He was going to stay till 7 last night, and we shut the doors at 6. So he was really, really quite keen to hang on. And
no, he was, yeah.
Really
yeah.
Nice chap. Colin is a card, as anybody who's met him. He's so entertaining. He's just on entertainment mode all the time. Even when I picked him up from Southampton, he was sat on his suitcases in entertainment mode, and it was... a joy to bring him over to the island. Somebody, not me, has got to have that joy taking him back over to his suitcase. I mean, his car. Tomorrow, so I'm looking for a volunteer. All funds are paid for. Do you want to do that one, Ben?
I'm going home on the 5:15 tonight.
You'll have
mate.
To 5:15.
Yeah.
Oh, that's no good.
We can probably do something.
Do the 5:45 then.
No, it's been cancelled. Nah, they're only running one ferry today, mate. That's why I was late. do you remember why I was late? Because I called you and told you I was late. That's why it's
been
cancelled.
Yeah, but you've already got a ticket, and I wouldn't have to buy that one again. I mean, that one.
I can do it if you need to.
Oh, Debbie wants to travel with Colin Baker. Yeah, so we've got about 10 minutes left now, so I'm going to leave that to you, Debbie. You're going to tell me exactly what you think of this event, because I can't, because I'm biased.
You're biased because you're running it, yes. No, but just being in with the traders, obviously it's hot in there, but the feeling is still good. Everybody's having a good time. Everybody's having fun. We just wish that there were quite a few more people. But
well, there's a few. It's a big area. I've seen people come in and not a lot of people leaving, which is fantastic. So and cosplay.
That's because they're all being killed out
cosplay
the back.
Cosplay is fantastic. Yeah, we got.
Jenny Linden got a bit hot, so we have to park her by the door because that's about the only air conditioner we have in there.
Very hot down there.
The thing though, the thing you've got to remember though, it is quite hot in the trading hall, but there are two ice cream vans out the side if anyone wants to cool down.
Yep.
I'll have to do my plug.
Yes, I will get you an ice cream. Will you stop it?
Will you get me an ice cream?
What sort of fan girl? Sorry, Kirby. Kirby speaking, everyone.
What? No.
Okay, he's listening. He's having a good time.
Must have been interference.
I'm listening, and you dropped out completely for about 30 seconds, too.
It doesn't matter. That was Debbie talking.
That must have been the best bit of the podcast.
Dead air.
So what fangirling? Fangirling? Is that the word?
Fangirling.
Have I been fangirling?
I bet you have.
When you get that big
not
up,
really
I bet
this
you will
time,
tomorrow
no.
after you've taken Colin Baker back.
I've had lovely conversations. John Neeson mainly has been the one. Yeah,
again, he's always doing K-9, isn't he?
He's absolutely fantastic. Just love talking to him. Mainly I've been talking to most of the cosplayers and getting pictures with them and just the support for especially from the cosplay fraternity has been absolutely astounding for this event. I mean, everybody like VJ as well, obviously going around doing every carnival and really promoting this.
There's
been a lot going on, and just obviously I've not been a part of that side of things, but it's been great to watch and just to see it all over Facebook, all over social media, and the response yesterday, obviously, from people who came, because word of mouth, especially on the island, is the way things go.
Yeah.
Spending
hundreds of pounds on publicity.
But it's because, obviously, with the ups and downs of last year, everybody's been really quite wary, and to have people just respond to it with open arms has been absolutely brilliant, and it's hopeful for any event we try and do in the future that this is a good jump-off place.
And we've also had Valila Shalabala, who's an absolutely delightful lady and very pretty. And I said to her, she did Rosita in The Next Doctor 11 years ago, and I said to her, she doesn't actually look any different apart from a barnet. And it's sickening. Really is.
Well, you've mentioned that lots of people are walking around in costumes, and a lot are looking fantastic. There's the Stormtrooper dressed up as Superman, which is just
that's
confusing.
Genius. Yeah, that's genius.
I do love crossover crossbow.
But I think the thing that gets me most. Who have you come as?
That mask you're wearing is me.
It reminds me of that bloke. What's that film?
I did Picard at the carnival.
The mask. Yeah.
No.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realise.
I also, with the cosplay competition, it was the efforts that people...
1:30.
Yesterday's one. There's another one today
at 1:30.
The efforts that people went into in sort of creating their own characters as well was quite good. I think the lady who won it was claimed as that Fluffy, I don't know what it was called.
That's the character she created herself. Yeah.
She built that costume herself, and she fully deserved to win that competition.
I've been watching her build that, on Facebook.
And she was thrilled to bits to win it. She wasn't interested in the tat she got. Where she was, but she wanted was that trophy and that title of cosplay champion. But she's not here today, so someone else can win it.
Isla and Tom are in again this time as well, aren't you? Yeah, you're cosplaying for me to this year, aren't you? I didn't get one together in time.
I can't cosplay because I'm wearing this shirt.
It's very dashing.
I think it's wearing
you. You cosplayed the other day.
Pardon?
He said I did cosplay. I did cosplay the other day. Yes, I was Jean-Luc Picard after a few burgers. but I was carrying the banner in the carnival and hid the evidence of the burgers behind the banner, so it did work quite well.
That's who you were.
Unbelievable.
I thought you just turned up in your tracksuit. I saw the photo on Facebook.
Why did I ask you to do this job?
You're asking yourself the same question as I am, but... I saw the photo and I thought, look, everyone else is in cosplay and Adster not wearing a tracksuit.
Thank you for that. Moving on to the guests.
So we
also
with
have
Star
David
Trek,
Finn.
Then, obviously.
David Finn was in lots of things, including Doctor Who, Game of Thrones, lots of American programs, and he's a lovely man.
And he did voices for Trolls. What characters did he do for Trolls? Piggy and Mr. Dinkle?
Yes.
Biggie and Mr. Dinkle. Biggie and Mr. Dinkle. Okay.
Yeah, and Izzy's currently sat with him, and I think they're getting on like a house on fire. So,
they're brilliant. Yeah, they sat with Josh, and they're
and of course
really
we've got Andrew Smith, Simon Boucher-Jones, and the delectable Robert Sheerman.
Oh, they're fantastic.
They're
fascinating
people. To talk to as well, and I've always got a story because they're
the
writers.
Table. Yeah, managed to get off the table and actually go and speak to them, and that's been terrific. I neglected my post for all of. Maybe a minute to go and speak each time. Yeah.
All right. Well,
this is the longest I've been away from it. I'm very worried.
We'll get back there in a minute. Right. we're about to wrap up because Roy wants to prepare the next segment of the show, which is. You got the item.
Mary has sent her apologies. She just.
That's
phased
not
out.
The next segment of the show, Debbie.
It's the writers' panel part two,
which is going to be hosted by Mr. Paul Wilson.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, you'll get your lunch break.
He's fantastic. He's stuck. who is currently stuck behind scooters and has told me to tell you he should be there any minute.
You might have to do a little bit.
Yeah,
of
you
the,
might
this.
Have to do this
what
one.
You give
then.
With one hand, you take away with the other.
Sorry about that.
I'll just tell you how hard I've been working for you here.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I bought two ham rolls to eat for my lunch. I took two ham rolls home yesterday and ate nothing, Adam.
Well, we bought lots and lots of sandwiches from M&S, and by the time I got up to eat any, there was a couple of flaky old cheese and onion ones left. So it works for both people, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Oh,
there's loads of cakes in the hall.
No. This is pretty much what the podcast is famous for.
I've got 24-hour-old ham rolls, if you'd like them, upstairs. I mean, in the green room, which is apt considering the sandwiches are now 24 hours old.
I'll stop moaning. There's loads of snacks in the building. And there's two ice cream vans outside, apparently.
And there's Mars bars in the green room, too.
There's Mars bars. Yeah.
Yes, we will go and get an
Mars
ice cream.
Is that your new catchphrase?
That's my new catchphrase for the podcast.
That's what she said.
Yes, we will get an ice cream.
I didn't got that. That's
that
in the
what she said. Right.
Anyway, so we're going to wrap up the show. Kirby, have you got anything to say?
I don't know what to say.
Well, it's hard to hear you.
I'm really pleased that we've been able
to actually dial into America rather than the other way around for a change.
It's been a bit superfluous, which is it's nice, actually. It hasn't really said much. Normally, you can't get a word in edgeways. I love it. We'll have to do this more often.
Yeah, don't you just hate it?
Affirmative, master.
Don't you just hate it when people talk all the time and dominate podcasts?
Well, like you mean? All right then. So anyway, thank you everybody for coming along.
Thank you for paying,
accidentally
putting up
watching
with us.
The wrong thing.
Yeah.
Don't worry, something good will follow shortly.
Yes.
And we will be on
Goodbye,
the podcast
Fancy
next
Pants.
Doing by Fancy Pants. We'll see. We'll be on for Megloss next week, isn't it?
Might be next week.
Yeah.
Next time.
Next time. Next time we'll be on for Megloss.
I thought it was next week.
Well, I've already
it
done
is,
the question, so we're good to go.
He doesn't. Kirby's never understood that life sometimes gets in the way of podcasting.
Oh, Kirby. Kirby.
Yes.
Are you coming to my mum and dad's 50th wedding anniversary party next week?
I don't think so.
It'll be there.
Congratulations.
Skype him in.
Did you not get the invite?
No.
There's a reason for that.
Crowdfund it.
Anyway, thank you everybody for watching, listening, and taking part in the show. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, Fancy Pants.
Bye, Kirby.
Bye, Mary. Oh. You know, I have to lift my glasses so I can see you. Hello. Yay. So let's kick off this afternoon's panels. We've got two Doctor Who panels on the way. The first one, please welcome to the stage Christopher Ryan, John Leeson, and Colin Baker. Do find yourselves a seat, gentlemen.
Move down the bus. Right. Oh, my word. More leg room. Right.
So I take it I don't have to do any introductions as to who's who. who's who.
I'm invisible, which is quite nice.
You're never invisible. So, Colin, Christopher, John, welcome. Day two. A Fantasy Con. How's it been for you so far?
Interesting. Everybody seems very pleasant. It can't be helped.
No, everybody's lovely, coming up and asking for signatures and telling us about themselves and asking various questions. So it's been fine, yeah.
People have been coming up to you for signatures.
Well, one or two. One or two.
Really? Didn't they know I was here? It's been very pleasant. Thank you both for coming.
Just on that point, I will point out that all three of these gentlemen are going to be available next door after we've finished. Four signatures, four photo opportunities.
They've all got them already.
They've all been here.
All this lot.
I recognise them.
We've seen them 17 times each.
Oh, well, in that case, there's an ice cream van out there, should you wish to go spend any more money.
It's very nice to see you.
So then, Doctor Who, where did it all start for each of you? Should we start with John, nearest me?
Affirmative.
Sorry, yes, for me, a friend of mine suggested to the BBC that I might be a suitable character to play a new character they were introducing back in 1977. And I got a call from my agent who said, John, I've just had a call from the BBC. As though he'd never had a call from the BBC before in his life. They want to know if you'd like to play not just one, but two parts in Doctor Who. What do you think? So I thought, this friend of mine, fantastic. He's really sort of got me going. This is brilliant. So my agent said, oh, no, steady. What are the parts there? Well, one of them is the voice of a virus, which I assume must have been the smallest part offer I'd ever get in my life. And the other one's the voice of a robot dog. What do you think? So I said to my agent, well, look, I'd like to get my face around the business a bit more. I'm a face actor. I know I do a lot of voice work, but there we are. He said, well, you might as well take it because it's only in for one storyline anyway. That was 42 years ago. And here I am.
Still playing the germ. Well, the virus. Did the virus not last?
Oh, the virus didn't last.
No.
No, they found something to deal with.
Antibiotics.
Yes, probably. Yes.
Yes.
Probably.
Shame they didn't have anti-canines. Yes.
And Christopher, you've had dealings with many doctors through the years, haven't you? And I don't mean the ones in surgeries.
No.
I mean the one on the... Yeah.
Yes.
Four or five, actually five, I believe, but one of them wasn't in Doctor Who, was it? You've worked with four doctors and then...
No, that's right. The first doctor, of course, was Colin in 1986, in Trial of a Time Lord. I think there were four episodes. Michael Jaston and Linda Bellingham were there, and others. The second doctor was a lot later, was 2007, shown in 2008, and that was David Tennant. And I was General Stahl. And I've done the Big Finish audio thing with Paul McGann. And the other doctor, who wasn't a doctor when I worked with him, was Sylvester McCoy, and that was in a play at the Savoy Theatre in London. That was Dario Fo's Can't Pay, Won't Pay. So there we are. I think that... Oh, no, I did work with Matt Smith as well. That's right. Playing another Sontaran in the Pandorica stories. That's right. I'd forgotten that. But there we are. Yeah. They're my doctors.
Do you have any scars from working with Sylvester?
Yes. Scars?
Yes. He's a bit violent on stage.
Scars as well. Yeah.
I did a stage thing with him, and he actually nutted the microphone and cut his own head open.
Yes.
He got carried away. He's a very physical actor.
He is. He often has ferrets down his trousers as well. When he worked with the Ken Campbell roadshow all those years ago.
And he's fired out of cannons.
Yes, fired out of cannons, and he plays the spoons. And
bloody nuisance, in fact.
A noisy actor. Yes, dear old Sylvester McCoy.
So, Colin.
Yeah. I've worked with a few doctors as well.
I know. And you were also obviously in Doctor Who before you were cast as the Doctor.
Well, I did that. Who was here yesterday? Yeah, you've heard it before, sorry.
It's all right. Everyone's used to repeats of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I played a character called Maxil in Ark of Infinity, who was a Gallifreyan guard, and I got to shoot Peter Davison. Well, I had all these requests for someone, please shoot Peter Davison. And as a result of doing that, I met the producer who liked the cut of my jib and offered me the part of the Sixth Doctor. That's the short version. I won't give you the whole thing from yesterday. So, which was very nice. And the interesting thing was, I'd said to my agent that it was rather sad that I was playing Maxil because it meant I would never be a doctor because I'd read that they never cast the Doctor from an actor who's been in the show before. And my agent said, well, they're not going to cast you, are they? So he was proved wrong. And the amazing thing was that when I was offered the part by John Nathan Turner, the producer, he asked me not to tell my agent for a few weeks. So he finally gave me the okay. And I was the one who rang my own agent and said, oh, by the way, I've been offered the part of... What? I said, I'll let you have some commission. I did play a practical joke on him once. It was April the 1st, and I rang my agent, and assuming an American voice, which I'll try to do now, saying, hello there, I hear you represent Colin Baker. And yes, I do. Well, I'm calling you out of Cubby Broccoli's office, and Cubby's in town at the moment, and he'd love to see your Colin Baker. Colin. What? Colin, yeah. No, his name is Colin. Oh, yeah, okay. Colin Baker. Is he free round this afternoon sometime to come down to the Dorchester Hotel to meet up with Cubby? And my agent said, well, what's it for? Is it a part in a James Bond film? Oh, no, he wants to see Colin because he thinks he would be a great James Bond. And my agent said, well, Colin Baker, page 369 in Spotlight, that Colin Baker? Yeah, yeah, said Cubby. Yeah, that's the guy. Cubby really likes him. Okay, I'll call him. Give me your... Took the details I gave him down. Put the phone down and waited. Pick it up. Hello. Hello, Colin, it's Barry. Oh, hello, Barry. Look, I've got you an interview this afternoon. I said, oh, what? What's it for? He said, Cubby Broccoli. I said, who's that? A vegetable? Cubby Broccoli? Stupid name. He said, no, he's the producer of the James Bond films. He wants to meet you this afternoon. I said, what time? He said, 3 o'clock. Oh, I can't, I'm going to Asda. And he went off on one. And I said, I know, was it that Harv Schwarzenheimer, which is what I'd identified myself as? Was it Harv Schwarzenegger? He said, yeah, do you know him? I said, I certainly do, Barry. He was livid. He was livid. He saw no April the 1st humour in it whatsoever.
Well, it's a shame. I think you'd have made a very good James Bond. I
still would.
Oh, well, of course, now you would, yeah.
I could be James Bomb. Boom, boom.
So there are any parts, talking about that, are there any parts you've seen over the years that you'd have liked to play that you've never got around to playing, either in Doctor Who or anything else you've seen?
Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins.
Again,
I'd love
I can
to play.
See that. Yeah.
What about you?
No, I'm always glad to be asked to do a job, whatever it is, you know, so there's nothing I hanker after, no. But I'll take anything that's going.
And John?
Well, it's rather, yes, I can understand that. The story I just briefly wish to tell is that when I first went to the States, Philadelphia, nobody, of course, knew what John Leeson looked like. They knew what K9 sounded like. So I thought, well, let's utilize this as an introduction. I said to the showrunner, can you lend me a long Doctor Who Tom Baker scarf and some badges, and I'll be one of the fans during the course of the day. I'll just melt into the scenery. And you tell the fans, because I'm being introduced at 4 o'clock in the big hall, tell them that I'm delayed from the airport, I'm in a taxi, I'm on my way, but whilst we're waiting, guys, let's have a K9 sound-alike contest. And I said to the showrunner, put me in about fourth or fifth. And so he put me in about fourth or fifth. What's your name? What's your name, guy?
My name's George.
Okay, where are you from, George?
I'm from Pittsburgh.
Got a big laugh. Big laugh. Okay, George, what are you going to do for us? So I did some K9 noises. Okay, thanks, George. Back to your seat, back to your seat. Next one up. And there were about six or seven of us online were called back because he just had a message in his ear that John Leeson was now in the building. And so we were all called back, hand over head, who was the best K9 sound-alike? And the little guy, two down from me, won. He did. But the showrunner was perfect. He said, okay, guys, all back to your seats, all back to your seats, because John Leeson's here, John Leeson's here. And so everybody, now will you please welcome John Leeson. And I just got up from my seat. Never in my life have I received an ovation like it.
But and so much hatred from that one man.
Yeah, probably.
What was the prize for second place?
Quite. There we go.
So, obviously, we've got three completely different kind of actors, really. We've got Colin at the end, very much known for, you know, how he looks, yep. Being Mr. Doctor.
Yes.
Hey.
Some people have seen
him. Be careful of this path you're taking. We are all exactly the same. Actors all do the same job.
Well, what do you say? You say that.
I do.
And I heard.
Yeah.
But then you've got Christopher, who, of course, Mike from The Young Ones. But then your Doctor Who characters, a lot of them you've obviously been in makeup or, you know, full body suits for some of them. And John, completely the opposite end, it's only ever your voice we hear.
Yeah, Yes.
I mean, I can see the canine, you know.
Yes. Well, there was also Bungle Bear in Rainbow. I was the original Bungle Bear, which was the hottest job I ever had in my life. And my replacement, because I couldn't stand... I was shrinking inside this rather venomous-looking bear costume. And the guy who took over me from me, I'm sure was only cast because he was already pre-shrunk. Yes. But
who was it? Who took over?
It was a chap called David Brierley.
Oh, I know David.
Yes.
Who was the better Bungle?
The best Bungle?
Yeah.
How many were there all together?
Me and him, I think.
No, there's more since then.
Were there?
Because my friends, Rod, Jane and Freddie...
Yes.
Were they
yes.
in it when you were in it?
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I was at...
From the beginning.
I was at Jane and Fred's wedding recently.
Well, I never...
Yes.
There's a thing. Never mind. We'll have
you,
a thought
you carry
about
on.
This now, yes.
Do you know Rod,
I'm
Jane
sure they're
and Freddie?
Them.
And it's not true, because Rod was married to Jane.
Right.
And they broke up. And a couple of years later, she got together with Freddie. It was not a question of them breaking up. A happy marriage.
I'd heard it was
I know what you're going to say.
This is how to be upstaged. This is wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what I was going to ask was, obviously, we've got the three different kinds. You know, we've got you very voice-orientated. Christopher...
Excuse me. You can't just walk in, pick up John Pertwee's head, and walk out. This is... You wouldn't do that in King Lear, would you?
That's better. That's better. Now pay attention.
It is a slight distraction, isn't it? Not something you can see every day. So anyway, what I was saying. So you've got the three of you, as I say, very recognisable for your characters, very recognisable for your voice, very recognisable for a bit of both. What would you prefer to be known for? Like in a John character where... people know your voice but don't know you, or do you like walking down the street and people shouting, hey, it's the doctor?
I'd rather be known as the man who drowned Donald Trump and got away with it. Will that do?
Well, in terms of the acting side of things, it's Being other people, not being yourself, creating other characters from the writing, which it always starts with the writing. So there's not, I can't think of how I'd want to be recognised. It's nice, it's actually nice not to be recognised, you know, because you can get on with your life. But very big, famous people, like Colin Baker, John Leeson, people like that, and movie stars, it must be, you can't go anywhere. So I can pop around quite happily, left alone.
I want to disillusion you. I can go anywhere.
You can go anywhere?
I can go anywhere.
Oh, right.
Nobody knows who the hell I am. When I come here, they do.
Yeah.
But when I'm shuffling around an OAP in the outside world, nobody notices.
Well, you go in disguise. You wear a hat, don't you? You do wear a hat.
Not usually, no.
Oh, okay.
No.
Well, I think aficionados would know you.
They would.
Yeah.
I've had this conversation actually with Rob Shearman only about half an hour ago. He would be talking about it because he was saying, do you resent having been hidden for maybe 40 years of your acting career? And the answer is not in the slightest. Because I've been particularly busy in the previous 20 years, all over the place. Theatre all over the UK, West End Theatre, Fringe Theatre in London, equally sitcoms, lots of... I was in Dad's Army, I was in Take Three Girls, Marry the Girls, I was in all sorts of different things. So I have actually been seen... and I have a career that I can look back on in terms of theatre, of which I'm justifiably, I wouldn't say proud exactly, but I'm satisfied that I turned up a good show. So let's put it that way. And K9, as I say, was just supposed to be a one-off. And look what happened. There we are. There's a surprise.
So we've all worked, well, apart from Colin, who's obviously a doctor. Who was the Doctor Who fan before working on the series? And who was your favourite doctor at that time?
I watched... I can't honestly say... See, these guys are Doctor Who fans. I can't honestly say I was that. But I watched it, if it was on. But bear in mind, there were no VCRs when I was watching Doctor Who. A video cassette recorders. Sweet old-fashioned thing that I am.
Have we got to the stage in life where we've got to start saying what VCRs are?
You are either in front of a television at 5:30 on a Saturday night, or you're not. So I watched it, because I liked it. And it's hard to believe, watching, as you doubtless have, either some or all of that very first episode with William Hartnell, that for us, that was state of the art. It was something we'd never seen the like of before. Now it just looks like silly old television, black and white, flickering. But then it was stunning, and I was riveted. I watched that first episode leaning on a railing in my flat in Paddington. I'd just come in the door, and it started, and I was leaning there, and I was still there 25 minutes later when it stopped, because it was just something new and different. And if at that moment a rift in the time zone had said, one day that'll be you, I would have made sure you were into an institution in irons immediately for being terminally insane. And that's what life turns up. So never doubt what might happen to you. It can happen to anyone.
Who would you say is your favourite doctor then, past or present, not including number six?
Well, I always avoid the F word. And for me, that is favourite. I've got four children. Which one's my favourite? I don't have a favourite. Well, I do, actually.
So do I. It's the one that brings in most money.
But I don't. And I get cross when other people insist on telling you that you're not their favourite doctor. My best one ever was a young man, rather intense, who came up to me and said, "Oh, hello, Mr. Baker. So nice to meet you. You are my fourth favourite." Sixth favourite doctor. I was demoted two places while he was talking to me.
How many had there been at the time? That's a more important question, isn't it?
So, yeah, you guys can have your favourites, but stop telling us. But I will always doff my cap to the second doctor, because Patrick did the hard job, the first regeneration. If he hadn't come out of that with such chutzpah and style and charm, we wouldn't be sitting talking about the programme now. Yep. So for that reason alone, if you insist on me having a favourite, it'll be him.
I'll certainly take the expression "doth your cap to him" instead of favourite. That's a good one. Christopher, yourself.
Well, I agree entirely that having a favourite a doctor, that, again, like with programmes, people ask it about things. The favourite programme you've done, each has a different quality, a different feeling, a different aura. I do remember William Hartnell, and it was great watching him. As Colin said, it was a completely new thing. There had been that Quatermass thing before that, but the Doctor Who took it somewhere else. And watching William Hartnell, I thought, this is great, because I'd love watching actors, and I thought, this man I've seen in a film called Brighton Rock, playing a villain. Also, he was Sergeant Major Bullimore in the Army Game, which was the comedy thing. And I thought, this is good. He's been given an opportunity. So even then, thinking in terms of characters and things, it is possible to play different people and make them believable, and, you know, for people to enjoy. So I haven't got a favourite, but I've worked with a few of them, and I did like William Hartnell very much. I think he was a terrific actor.
Of course, you mean second favourite Doctor was William Hartnell.
Yeah. But it was lovely working with him too in 1986, and that was my first acting Doctor Who experience. So there we are.
And John, you've worked with a couple as well.
Yes, I have.
I won't ask you who's your favourite, because obviously, you know, I'll ask you instead. Who would you doff your cap to, sir?
Who would I doff my cap to? Difficult to say. I'm just seeing if I've got enough money to pay this gentleman.
I don't know. No, you haven't.
No, I haven't.
I'm the one who has to pay you.
Well, no, I must say, K-9, of course, is a servant, and he's terribly loyal, and he keeps his master out of trouble as much as he possibly can. And I'd like to keep Tom Baker out of trouble as much as I possibly can as well. He was amazing to work with. We are, as they say, chalk and cheese. We have completely different temperaments, but we are both actors who know how to give a performance. And Tom, although being mad north by northwest, was just magnetic to be involved with. Absolutely magnetic. I pay tribute to what you say about Pat Troughton, because I do believe he did a tremendous amount of spade work in the early days of Doctor Who. But I'm afraid it does have to be Tom. Sorry, Tom. Can't be helped.
So when it comes to villains, because Doctor Who's obviously got your goodies and your baddies.
Are you going to ask us about favourites again?
No, I'm not.
Or who I doff my cap to?
No, I'm not. Christopher, who is your favourite baddie?
Can you say that again?
We're talking villains now. Yes. Ones you've acted up against, obviously, Colin's done more than yourself in Doctor Who, but... Yeah. Your favourite, well, maybe not ones you've acted with, ones you've seen on the
a Doctor Who villain.
Yeah.
Well, I have to confess that I've watched, as I said, William Hartnell. I've watched here and there through the years the various Doctors, but I wasn't like most of you, all of you, I should think, out there, an aficionado. I wasn't someone who watched it, knew everything about it. So again, and this isn't just getting out of it. I can't think of. I mean, I know people talk, the Daleks were the big one and still are, and people talked about hiding behind the sofa and things like that. Cybermen, those angels are frightening that turn to stone.
Oh, yes.
The weeping angels, right. Yes. You see, that's how little I know. But there are so many. There's so many. I don't know, because I don't know enough about it. I haven't seen enough to actually comment in a full way on that.
Yeah, John.
Yes, it's interesting. I sometimes find fans coming to the table to quiz me about certain details in a story that I may have recorded way back 40 years ago. Say, do you remember, John, in the Stones of Blood, when there was this scene where such and such and such happened, but what do you think was the outcome? What do you think should have happened? I haven't a clue. I really don't remember. What do you mean you don't remember? You were in it. And they get quite shirty. But of course, they're watching all the repeats and things like that, and much like Chris here. And I'm not actually a sci-fi or sci-fantasy fan myself. I'm a working actor. Now, if this sends me away with a black mark, it probably does in your company, which I value enormously. But that's the case.
Right, let's deal with these weeping angels, shall we? The Doctor was that Tennant chap, wasn't it? And if you blink, they can go whoosh, get close to you. So why don't you, when you're talking to a weeping angel, just switch neatly from one eye to the other, right? And they can't get you. They have the wrong Doctor. T dealing with them. It's a shame because it is a, it's such a lovely idea, blown out the water by an intelligent doctor. My favourite villains are the Slitheen, because they fart. Farting monsters. They walk around going, what's not to like?
Fair enough. Right, should we get some questions from the audience? Has anyone got anything?
Before you do, I want you, young lady with the glasses on, to do me a great favour. Could you pick up that notice on the chair, show it to the rest of, and touch it? Thank you.
Very good, very good.
You've been driving me mad. Why can't we touch that piece of paper?
That was the first thing I did when I got here yesterday morning, 8:30, walked past and touched it.
Yeah.
Anyway, questions.
All right,
questions,
upstaged me. You're better than me.
Oh,
you did it before me.
You haven't touched it yet.
I don't want to touch it.
Please, touch it, Colin.
Not now you've touched it.
Let's hope no one's standing behind there heard that, eh? Right then, questions.
Oh, I thought you were going to the sea monster. Is that what it is?
Hello, team. Thank you for coming. It's one for the entire panel. Is there been any actor in the profession that you have been starstruck or in aware of their presence? And how did you deal with it?
Oh, so many. There are so many wonderful actors in this job. And then you get to work with them. And they're still wonderful. No, I wasn't. I can see why you laughed. I mean, for instance, one of the most exciting things I ever saw was an actor called David Warner playing Hamlet in 1960, whatever it was. We had the long scarf, and everyone said, oh, that was to copy Doctor Who. It was 7 years before Doctor Who, and he played it like a student. And he was the first Hamlet speaking that I ever understood every single word of. And I could identify him. Mm. He was a young man that he could be me or you or anybody. And it was wonderful. And then I got to work with him doing a big Finnish audio. And I was a gibbering wreck for about 5 minutes. And he's such a lovely, charming, self-effacing young man. Well, he's not young. He's a little bit older than me. That it doesn't exactly lance the boil, because I still think he's a wonderful actor. But now I can view him as a friend. And that happened once before. I saw an actor called Richard Easton play Richard II in Wimbledon in 1960s. And that was another wonderful performance. And he was one of the regular characters in The Brothers, playing one of the three brothers. And I was in that for 3 years. And he became a very close friend. So that's what's lovely about our profession. I mean, you may put people on a pedestal, but when you meet them, there's no pedestal, or you join them on it, or whatever. But most actors, there are some exceptions, aren't there? Most actors don't view themselves as people that you should put on a pedestal. There are one or two who do, and if you ask me privately, I'll tell you, because they deserve everything they get. Your turn.
My turn. Yes. Well, there are lots of actors that I've seen through the years and admired and respected more than me, because I don't think I've worked with any, you know, really sort of big, huge. But if to answer, well, apart from Colin, but people. The actors that I've liked through the years, and again, it can vary from television to theatre to film. In film, it can go back many, many years on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world. One actor I've always admired, because I thought he had everything, was Cary Grant. He could play a romantic lead, he could be sinister, he could be a clown, he had so much. Another actor, and he was an actor, but regarded as a comedian, again from a long time ago, but one of my heroes, was a man called Will Hay, who was fantastic.
Absolutely. Brilliant.
On the American side,
because Cary Grant, of course, was Archie Leach from Bristol. But on the American side, film actors, so many. One who was a film actor, but mainly on television, was known for films, but, you know, he made a big impact on television with his wonderful dry wit, his relaxation, his charm, was an actor called James Garner. James Garner.
Yeah.
The Rockford Files was his big thing, but of course he played Maverick in the 50s. And of course, in this country, for me, the top of the tree was an actor called Paul Scofield, who played Sir Thomas More famously in A Man for All Seasons, but many, many other parts. Always worked in theatre, did a few films, that one being the biggest.
Refused a knighthood
on several occasions, and was well loved and well respected throughout the profession, I think, really, as well as not that well known generally, unbelievably so. But if anybody hasn't heard of him or seen him, try and get hold of a DVD or watch the film of Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons. And Robert Shaw was a terrific Henry VIII in that.
Yeah.
Nigel Davenport was in that. There were many. John Hurt, young John Hurt, was in that. Vanessa Redgrave, so many people. But it's a terrific, terrific film. Was a play before a film, but that's my answer to that.
Yeah. And John?
Well, so many, really. But one I worked with in a play in the West End was Michael Hordern. Michael Hordern was playing in a play called Flint by David Mercer. He was an elderly clergyman who had lascivious designs on one of the young parishioners, and I was his very snotty curate at the time. But Michael was absolutely phenomenal in working so closely with how this character's thought processes went. The first night's performance, one would have thought, could not possibly be bettered. But during the run of the play, and it ran for quite a little while, he was like a terrier at a bone. He was sucking all the taste and flavor and goodness that he could find in this character, finding little things that just illuminated a moment, say. But when you've got other actors on stage and there's an actor like that performing, everything is pulled up to his level. You know, it's not just something straight out there to be admired and applauded greatly at the end of the day. He was very much a team player actor, Michael. He was absolutely tremendous. Morning, nice to see you. Oh no, it's not morning, is it? No. So yes, I think of all the actors I've worked with, Beatrix Lehmann was another super performer. And she actually gave me a present at the end of the Doctor Who thing we were doing. This was Stones of Blood, where she played Professor Rumford. Look it out, you'll find it. She was absolutely tremendous. Had a wonderful history of working with Sir Ralph Richardson and people like that.
She went out with him when she was young.
She did indeed.
She told me a story about that.
Yes.
She said he took her because he was mad about motorbikes.
Yes.
But he was also learned how to fly an aeroplane. Yep. And she said when he went on his bike, he would turn left and right without signalling. Yep. In the air. When he was going to turn right, he put his arm out.
yes, indeed. But one final thing. She gave me, at the end of her performance, and we got back to London, she was in rehearsals, and we were rehearsing for the next studio, the last one. She came into the rehearsal room with a greengrocer's paper bag, and she said, "This is for you, dear." "Yes, Beatrix? Well, something for lunch, is it?" "No. No, I was given this by a very, very dear friend a long time ago, and now it is yours because you took some nice pictures of me out on location. I looked in the bag, and it was the 1937 Leica camera that Sir Ralph Richardson had bought her. And that is my most treasured possession of the theatre. I've taken it to conventions, and it hasn't come here today, but it still works. It's a terror to load, but it's a pretty good present. And sadly, Beatrix passed away only a couple of weeks after having finished filming and recording. The last job she did.
Oh. Well, we've got another question up here.
Hey guys, it's me again. Basically, if there was anything you could change about Doctor Who that you couldn't do before but you could do now, what would it be and why?
I can't answer that. I can't. I'm sorry. I don't know. What can you change? If anyone, I haven't thought about that.
All right. Yes, I can. Right.
Of course.
I'll help
you
out. Assuming I had a time machine, I would go back in time and prevent Michael Grade's parents from meeting. If they didn't meet, he couldn't come and cancel the program in 1984 and order my removal in 1986. And I'd still be playing the part. There you are.
Insufficient information.
Lovely. Any more questions? Oh.
Should be good.
Have we got a translator?
Yes, we do need a translator. Any translator?
Sorry, the TARDIS is here.
That's true.
TARDIS does it for you.
Do you speak?
I don't know where to quite put this.
Oh, I could tell you.
I was always rather curious about Cyril's favourite food, the marsh minnows. And are they as delicious as they sound? I was curious about Cyril, the slug man's favourite food, marsh minnows.
Marsh minnows, yes.
Are they delicious? They sound delicious.
Oh. Did you eat any of them?
No, I didn't. But I'm sure Syl does, and that's
it was jelly with
something
in them.
Yes.
That was inoffensive.
Yes.
It looked offensive, but it wasn't.
I don't think I had any marshmallows, but you're right. That's Syl's favourite food. But what was the question?
Were they delicious?
Oh, were they delicious?
Were the marshmallows?
I can't. I've got to say it again. I can't answer that question. But I promise you, because I will be seeing Nabil Shaban in November, because we've done a DVD of a new Syl story, I will ask him. And if I can recognise you next time, I'll let you know.
Can I just mention that I had the great pleasure of working with Peter Capaldi, or seeing Peter Capaldi, rather, because he'd worked on The Thick of It and some wonderful, wonderful comedies. But his doctor and I were at a convention in Baltimore, I think it was last year or even at the beginning of this year. Time travel's not my thing. But word had got back to me that he'd been asked who was his favourite character in Doctor Who. And he said, K-9. Fine. Then he was asked why. Because he's got an off switch. So word got back to me on this. And I thought, well, I'm going to pay him back for this. I've never met him in the flesh, so to speak. But I'm going to creep up behind him while he's in a long line of signing folks. And so I did. And I said,
interruption, Master. I have disabled my off switch.
And I've never had such a welcome from Peter Capaldi.
Lovely stuff.
When the doctors are crying, that's one of the stories where... Sorry. Well, it's one of the stories where... and I can't remember which one it is, but obviously you do your changes and the doctors generally come out of the TARDIS when that all happens and you morph into the next doctor. And so he's just talking about how you change and how's that actually done. I mean, obviously there's the camera trickery and what have you. Sorry for anyone that's spoiling the illusion.
How is what done?
So, your regeneration, that's the word I'm thinking of. How the
regeneration's
done.
Oh, well, that's... Yeah. The old time on a way of lying on the floor, going very still, the camera stops, you get up, the other one lies down, and they start the camera again. And it's and then they do clever trickery afterwards. But it's pretty much that.
And that does bring to an end our panel.
Yes.
So,
thank you for coming.
Please put your hands together.
Thank you very much. Thank
for
you.
For Colin Baker, John Leeson, and Christopher Ryan.
Knowing that music probably means you'll know the lady sitting next to me.
You might.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Jenny Linden. Look.
Oh, thank you.
Now, obviously, we know Jenny from many, many things. You've been acting for four decades?
Yes, exactly right. Yep.
And you've done...
What have I done?
Well... I have a list here of things you have done, just to remind you.
Yeah.
We've got The Saint.
Absolutely, with Roger. Dear Roger.
With Roger, Roger.
Yes, I did two Saints, and one of them Roger directed.
All right.
And that was absolutely so good. He was a lovely, lovely man, but it was so good when he directed, because all the crew loved him. So everything was so relaxed, you know?
He really did have that vibe about him, that he was very... chilled out, very laid back.
Incredibly.
So he was like that as a producer as well, was he?
He was very laid back. He was also very funny, and he was full of practical jokes. And one of them was in the film Moonraker, and the set was set up for an aeroplane to go up in the air. So there's the actor sitting in the aeroplane next to Roger, and then the cue came, and the aeroplane was meant to be flying in the air. So they were off and they were doing their scene, and you could see through the back window there was a props man with a cloth cleaning out the windows of the... And Roger had set it up. Of course, he got into huge trouble for these, because it's very expensive. Every shot you do is very expensive. And so he was totally forbidden to do them. But he was a practical joker, very funny man.
It must have taken a long time to get used to work with... To get used to working with someone like Roger, who had a personality about him.
What do you mean? When I first did the first thing?
Yeah, when you first walked in and
He's so nice. He's so lovely that you don't worry. Roger's very welcoming to everybody. Very friendly. Very welcoming man. He's not scary. The directors were more scary, actually. So when he directed his own, it was all laughs and fun. He's a good man. Then I did The Persuaders with Roger Moore and Tony Curtis, and that was we did in France. One of the episodes we did was in France, and that was a great success. It was originally called The Friendly Persuaders, and they took the name out, Friendly, in case they weren't. but it was called Persuaders, finally, but it was a very... very good thing to be in. Great fun. And Tony Curtis, another lovely man.
See, we're learning stuff already. Yeah. I never knew it was called The Friendly Persuaders before they...
Yes, absolutely.
I love that. That's brilliant. So we've done The Persuaders, but you were also in The Avengers.
Yes, with dear Patrick McNee. And I was also in a play with Patrick at the Savoy Theatre in London before it burnt down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, burnt down soon after.
It wasn't... What, you didn't leave anything on, did you? It wasn't a hairdryer or anything like that?
No, it just happened to, and they rebuilt it.
It's pure coincidence.
And the play was called Killing Jessica.
Right.
And it's as bad as... It was as bad as the title, actually.
It sounded like great fun doing it, though.
Not good, but lovely to work with Patrick again. He's a lovely guy. He stayed at the Savoy, which he loves, and he got treated like a king.
Yeah.
And the Avengers is the thing that I did with them, first of all. Another charming man. Now, Honor Blackman. With Honor Blackman. And, yes, it was quite early on in my career, and it was exciting to work with these lovely people.
And then, it was Black Beauty.
Oh, my God. Where have you brought that out from?
Beauty!
Black Beauty.
I can do that, all right.
Oh, Black Beauty with Judy... Little girl, Judy something.
Judy Honeysham.
Yeah, yeah. Look on your phone. Yeah. Judy something.
I'll look quickly while you fill in.
She was the lead. And I can't remember what I did in it. That you are going back so far. You're going back a long, long time.
Well, we've got a long way to go back still. But then after that, we had the Tales of the Unexpected. You did an...
Yes, just Tales of the Unexpected. I did that with... I can't remember any names now. Who? Oh, okay. You might remember. Anyway, Tales of the Unexpected. Yes, that they had a lot of episodes of that. Can't remember. I never remembered the plots or the stories of anything I've ever done. And I also can't quote from the plays I was in. You do find the actors who quote. They've done Shakespeare plays. They're quoting the whole speech. No, I can't quote. And I don't remember the plot. So people tell me, all you lovely fans, you know much more about what I've done. You know what I was in. You know what I said. You know what I was wearing. And that's the stuff I've absolutely forgotten, because if you keep it in your brain, then you've got too much information. you can't learn anymore.
That's got to be a good thing, though, because that means that at the end of everything, you can go home and either watch it on DVD or pull up something, you know, old and watch it, and it'll be brand new to you, even though you were in it.
Yes. it's quite right. I never... too much information. You can't learn. You've just got to learn it and then let it go.
Well, that's it.
And let it go.
If you remember it everything, then...
Ooh. I wouldn't be sitting here at the age I am.
Exactly. And then we move on to... Well, we've got Lovejoy next on my list.
That's shown a lot, isn't it?
It's still on UK Gold every 15 minutes, I think.
And I think most people say to me, Lovejoy's on, it's so good, and aren't you lucky? I said, what do you mean, lucky? And they said, well, all that cash, all that money. Now, no. Our union, no. We had the fee, we were paid the fee, and a tiny thing towards possible repeats. So no, I don't get anything. Equity also, I'm maligning Equity, because they never arranged for any money when your film is shown. So Doctor Who and the Daleks is shown again and again and again. People keep saying, you must be so rich. No. Sorry to disappoint you. But it was a bad contract. I think they've altered it now for the young people. I hope so. It was a bad contract.
Well, you got to hope so, haven't you? But let's move on to that, then. The thing that we probably know you most for.
Yeah.
Doctor Who and the
Daleks.
1965, that was.
Good. Yes, it was.
Take us back to the time where you walked on set for the first time. Well, actually, take us back before that. How did you actually get the role, then? Hopefully this is one of the things you can remember.
Yes, I didn't test for it. That's what I was thinking, Ben.
Why didn't you?
I didn't test, but I think Gordon, the director, what's his name? What? Very good. Thank you, sir.
Aren't they?
Thank you.
Aren't they?
They're so good.
We need to take this lot around with us.
Can we take it with us everywhere we go?
They know more about you and me than you and me do.
Gordon Fleming. I think he saw something I was doing on television or even the West End. I don't know. Anyway, I got that movie. But the beautiful thing was that Peter Cushing was in it, because he became a great, great friend. Mm. And his wife, Helen, they became great, great friends of my husband and myself. And he used to live in Whitstable, and we used to go and stay with him. Before I live on the island now, but we lived in Hertfordshire. So it was lovely to see the sea. So we'd got Roy, darling Roy, so talented, Roy Castle. He used to practice his trumpet and do his tap dancing in the dressing room, which was next to mine, all the time during the film. He never lost a moment when he didn't practice. He was so funny. And those of you who quite like the movie, you'll see that Milton Sobocki, who wrote it, wanted it to be Swiss Family Robinson, no violence. Mm-hmm. He wanted comedy, which was very new. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people object to that. They want it to be more serious, like the television. Absolutely fine. But Milton did this deliberately. That's why Roy was in it. So that it made it much more lighthearted.
He did have a big lift in the film, didn't he? He did bring a lot of energy.
It was a different... It wasn't like the television.
No, not at all, was it? No.
So don't even compare it. But Roy was funny and darling. Peter was eccentric old professor. And Peter was often known as Creepy Cushing because he played all these very creepy roles, weird roles. And, of course, this was not... This was his first, and he was eccentric, kindly old professor. He was lovely. Roberta Tovey, she's still alive, I guess. The other two have gone. Gordon has gone home. I think they've... Oh, yes, and two of the Towels have gone. Michael Coles and John somebody, they've all gone home. Sometimes I think I'm the only one left here now.
Well, I'm glad you're still here. Otherwise, yes. I'll be sitting on stage talking to myself.
Yes.
So you got the role. You didn't have to audition for it.
No. I just did it. Just got it. I think he'd seen something.
You got a call saying...
I got a call saying, would you do this? So, I mean, of course you would. Of course you would. It was a brand new thing. And it was a first. It was in colour. Something that Doctor Who had never been.
It was the first BBC thing to be shot in Technicolor and widescreen.
Yes, it was. So a lot of firsts about this movie. And I am aware people don't like it. And I'm aware that people do like it. And I think that's fair enough. It didn't appeal to everybody, but it would to some.
Well, yeah, it does have contrasting opinions from people. Some people are like, well, it's not proper Doctor Who.
I know.
Other people are like, well, it's good enough.
It's entertainment for the young.
Well, it is, isn't it? It's not canon, though, is it? It's not part of the canon. Does that worry you at all? Does that...
No, because I... nothing worried me. If you get worried by the business that I'm in, you won't live very long. No, it didn't worry me. No, I tell a big lie. The only thing that did worry me was after I did a movie called Women in Love, which was Ken Russell's second movie, I was invited to do a movie called Straw Dogs, which Susan George did finally. The role was absolutely ghastly, and I told the director, Sam Peckinpah, that this was not even a... There wasn't a character to this woman. She was just a woman who was basically abused. Oh, they said, Dustin Hoffman is... I said, yeah, I know. Lovely, a lovely, wonderful actor. But you must want to do it. I said, no, I don't want to do it. Now, when you say things like that, you're already in a box that's not ticked. You really are not popular. But I think I was 28... and I just said, no, I don't want to do this. So the second film I was offered was Midnight... Wait a minute. Not Midnight Cowboy at all.
I was going to say, I don't remember seeing you at Midnight Cowboy.
Marlon Brando. And I've forgotten the title. I would do, because it was another dreadful script. Mr. Michael Winner was in charge of that. And I said to Mr. Michael Winner... There isn't a character there for an actress to play. It's just another abusing women. I'm not doing that. Well, I exited his door with the script following me. Boom!
Really? Oh, yeah.
Very unpopular.
I can imagine he was very all right about it and just said, oh, don't worry, Jenny, that's fine.
Oh, we wish. No. That was very Michael Winner,
wasn't it? That's the impression we all got of him.
No, I wasn't going to do that stuff. What was the name of the director who's in prison? The Me Too thing.
Oh, yeah, yes, no.
You know.
Yes, I know the one you mean, yeah.
Yeah, he was imprisoned for... yes, I can't hear you, but I'm sure you said... Yes, it was...
Was in prison.
It's going on all the time, but I wasn't really aware of it. I just knew intuitively this isn't the thing to do. I'm not doing that because I was quite young at the time. But you do... You then get ignored. You then get ignored. And the thing about the business is, it's not the first film you do. that makes you a star. You can be good in it and give them good notices. It's the second film. It's the follow-up. Well, then you become to get on the role, and then you get on America's role, you know. But it didn't happen quite like that for me, because I blotted my copybook, but I was very glad I did, indeed, because I still feel the same, and I wouldn't like my little grandchildren to see the stuff that I turned down at all.
So. Well, that's the thing, though, isn't it? Because if you get offered something that you're not happy doing...
Yeah,
it can quite easily take your whole career in a path that you don't actually don't want to take that.
Absolutely. Well, Women in Love was fine because it was D.H. Lawrence, and it was a very good movie because Russell could make films. He's a very good master at it, actually, and it had beautiful actors in: Alan Bates, Oliver Reed, Glenda Jackson, of course, and it was obviously a spectacular break, you know. But you need about 60 breaks if you're going to make it.
Yeah, they need to keep on coming, don't they? Because you're only as good as your last film, and you only remember as long as the last film is out. Yeah. So, after that. So, anyway, so back to Doctor Who.
Yes.
So, the TARDIS then. When you first walked onto the set.
Time and relative dimension. What? Dimension.
Yeah. I'm not going to help you. You're going to get it right yourself.
Time and relative dimension in space.
There you go. So when you first walked in there, onto the set?
Bill Constable did the sets.
Yep.
And I must say it was a very memorable moment. You walked on to this other world. He had built the other world completely at Shepperton, vast studio. And you saw the Dalek City. You saw the jungle. You saw the corridors that the Daleks were going to go up and down. All in one shot, you know, it's all around you. I thought it was breathtaking. It was made of cardboard, plastic, metal, anything, silver paper, you know. But it was brilliant, and I think he was almost the star of the show, because it was very clever. We didn't move outside that studio. It was just all studio work, and I thought he did incredibly well.
It was 6 weeks filming, I think, wasn't it? 6 weeks.
It was about that, yes.
What was your favourite part of the filming?
Trying not to laugh. Because you see, Roy, to do serious stuff with Roy Castle, forget it. The Daleks, people say, what was it like being attacked by Daleks, you know? Daleks are sort of the beginning of the robot situation that we have fully now. And they were designed by Ray Music. And he had designed the Daleks for a six-year-old child, so they were made of lavatory bits, the plungers and all the things, the ball cocks, excuse my French, all going into this Dalek. And so it was really like a toy, and it had these plungers which sprayed white foam, which put out fires, extinguisher, really. It was going to be something that fired fire. And Milton Sobotsky said, no, we can't have that. It's too frightening and it's dangerous. So we have this white foam. Well, and, you know, inside the Dalek are these retired ballet dancers. And they were very dainty on their castor wheels. They were good. They were great fun. And they used to teach Ray to tap dance in the lunch hour, you know. They had to maneuver these things, the Daleks, without bumping into anything. And it was very difficult. You could see it was difficult. So we had to reshoot and reshoot. And going down the corridor, you get the drunk Dalek, you know. that was very funny. And we had to pull ourselves. Gordon got very cross with us because we did laugh. We did get the giggles, and Peter as well. It was dreadful. Because you would, really, wouldn't you?
Well, you've got to have fun while you're doing it as well, haven't you?
Exactly.
You talk about the fun you'd have had with Roy Castle back in the day, because you always seemed like... Was there any pranks on set that you pulled that you probably, looking back, maybe shouldn't have done, or was it all on the level?
Well, Gordon was quite a strict taskmaster, so there weren't too many pranks that were allowed through. But there's a shot in the film where I have to stick some goo onto the eye of the Dalek, and that was funny because when I did the first take, I stuck the goo onto the Dalek's eye, And when I came away, I got half the Dalek with me. So we did that shot several times. You know, things like that.
What was your favourite scene that you were in? Was that your favourite scene that you were in on in the movie?
Oh, or? Gosh, what a question. Because they were all fun. They were all nice. Favourite scene
that you were in? Because we'll do the scene that you weren't in next.
Well, I was just going to go a little... reminded me of something when you said that, because one of the notices from Kinney Weekly said how wonderful Roy was, how wonderful Peter was, and Jenny Linden and Roberta Tovey couldn't do much in the film because they were only girls. And I thought, the script was a little bit like that, obviously. Yeah. Obviously,
it was at the time.
So I couldn't say that there was a scene or anything. I liked all the scenes. It was fun to be in. Let's put it that way. But I haven't got an absolute favourite, really. Except it was quite fun with the Tiles, because I knew one or two of them. These great strapping. They looked like Adam Faith. and they had public school accents, which was quite funny. And they were asked, before they joined the cast, they had to have their chests shaved and their arms shaved, so they were smooth-skinned. And I said, well, what about the female Tiles? Because there were female Tiles as well. But the scenes with them were nice and fun and everything. And with the Daleks, I liked it all.
So you did that film?
Yes. And then where are we now, Ben?
Wow. We're a long way past that film.
But it's still watched, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still watched, and it's still relevant, obviously.
Thank you very much for still watching. Because it's fine for the kiddos too, isn't it? The really little ones. It's quite nice for them.
Well, yeah. It is. And what I like about it is it's... Because it's removed from the canon, it can be a bit more fun. And it was, as you said there, I mean...
It was intentionally that, from Sabotsky's point of view. He just wanted a light Swiss Family Robinson show, really.
It was more entertainment than serious, wasn't it? And it was. I think that shows, you know, the differences between the films and the TV series. So, shall we throw it open to the audience, Jenny, and see if anyone's got any questions?
Yes, anything you like within reason.
Anybody? No,
you
got,
know.
Okay. This is where I'll do my Jeremy Kyle thing.
Oh yes.
This is what it's like when you're 44 and your knees are knackered. The climb off the stage. Hi, what's your name?
Hello, my name's Karen.
Okay, Karen, what would you like to ask Jenny?
Forgot now. Before you got the part in the Dalek film, had you watched the show before?
Oh, had I watched the Daleks before?
Come on.
A little bit, but because I'm rather old, I wasn't one of those people that was standing behind a sofa quite frightened, because that's what I get told by a lot of fans, that they watched it from behind the sofa. I think I was a little bit older, so I didn't do that. But I did watch it, but I wasn't a sort of I must watch Doctor Who fan. In fact, when I did the film, I wasn't really connected to watching the television, which in a way is a good thing, because you just try and be the same, or you're trying to... it was fortunate. I wasn't. But I think now, I think it's absolutely... it's an amazing program, but I have a little bit of an issue with making the Doctor feminine. I have an issue.
I love you. I love you. So, no, do you know, that's my view on it as well. And it's quite an unpopular view,
refreshing.
Unfortunately, Jenny. I don't think many people agree with us. But
Well, I can't understand totally why actresses want to play... like Lear or something, a male, a very male part. Yeah. I haven't got it. I don't understand it. To me, Doctor Who is very masculine. Yeah. It's a very male role. And I don't think it benefits, because men and women think differently and it's written for them differently. I don't think it benefited. And I'm sorry, because they're all good actors and I want it to succeed. But I have an issue with changing that to a woman.
I think what it is for me is that as you said, it was a very masculine role. And there's no problem. Yeah. If you want to do a female Time Lord show, do a female Time Lord show.
Exactly.
Why, They're saying bringing in James Bond, they're going to try and make a female.
Ah, no, don't.
What?
Go
no,
there.
No. Look, don't they want to do it. I've got no problem with it. I don't think it's a sexist thing to say that Doctor Who was a male, should have stayed a male. Yeah. Want to do a female Time Lord show? Bring out a female Time Lord show.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. Yeah. Unfortunately, as lots of people who listen to the podcast attached to the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast, which I do occasionally with Adam, who's run all, set all this thing up, it's just a case that it's squawkers. It's people who just want to complain about something. And so that people have to change what they're doing to appease these people. And they're going, that's not fair. You can't do that.
That's
got.
That's right.
It's not necessary.
No.
You could have left, you know, Doctor Who as a male, no one would have minded.
It was very powerful with Peter, wasn't it? Peter Capaldi. I did watch a lot of his work. Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
It was a very powerful programme.
Slightly less swearing than I expected after seeing him in his last roles. He managed to flip and do it all right, didn't he? So, who would he be your favourite Doctor? Bearing in mind who's in the next room.
Exactly.
Apart from Colin Baker, who would be your favourite Doctor?
Well, it was Colin Baker. No, I think actually it was
Tom Baker.
Mm. I liked his performance very much.
Did you meet Tom?
Yes, Tom Baker. With a scarf.
Did you ever meet him, ever do any work with Tom?
Only at charities, things like this, at conventions, charities. I didn't work with Tom, no.
Which Doctor would you have liked to work with most, apart from Tom and Colin? We're narrowing it down, aren't we, eventually?
Which Doctor? Oh, you're awful at these questions, aren't you?
Thank you very much. I pride myself on appalling questions, Jenny.
Very good. Which Doctor would I like to have worked with most? What about the very first Doctor that ever was? What was his name? He was
William Hartnell.
Yes, that will do, won't it? I haven't thought about it.
Well, that's a good enough answer because it's in the ballpark. So therefore, it's right. Do we have any more questions from the audience? Anyone with any questions for Jenny?
It's hard questions, isn't it? It really is.
I mean, I've got a million of them. I can carry on all day, but you're probably...
If there's anybody out there...
We have a question over there. Luckily, Jenny.
Oh.
I've got steps on this side of the stage.
Right up there.
Look at that. Okay. Hi.
Hello, Jenny. Have you got any stories about your work with Roger Moore?
I didn't hear the last bit.
We've had a few, but we'll have some more stories about working with Roger Moore, if you have any more of them.
Is that on?
Oh, there we go.
So were they hearing?
They could hear. We just boosted your signal a little bit. Using the transponder, we've reversed the polarity.
I can't directly say. I mean, he was a terrific guy. You know this, don't you? We're very sad he's gone. He worked right to the end of his life for children. Charity. He did his own show. Did you see that one that came to Portsmouth? No, you didn't.
Oh, didn't know that.
He's married three times, and his last wife was, I forget her name, but she was very lovely, and that was the best time of his life. Got two children, and he was just a good guy. Roger never took himself seriously. That was his great gift. He was as good, he knew he wasn't a great actor, and he was just himself. But funnily enough, to project yourself onto a big screen is very hard. So people thought he was doing an easy job. It's not. Actors love to have costumes, dialects, wigs. He never had any of that, and he was just himself. So projecting yourself onto a big screen is very, very difficult. Roger did it beautifully. He was a brilliant man. I wish I could remember more about the jokes he did, because he was a jokester, but I can't at the moment.
Well, he's an absolute
Thank
legend,
you for
isn't
asking.
He? So we've got 5 minutes left, Jenny.
Five minutes
to go.
Well, let's see if I've got a question for. Do any of you like Hammer films? Yes, Hammer film. Because when actors start, you always do a Hammer film, and I did mine, and it was called Nightmare, and I had to audition for that, Ben.
I should hope so. You can't get all roles by the auditioning.
I was quite young, and I had to get out to Windsor Studios to audition for this role. And I was playing in the theatre down in Worthing, the Connaught Theatre, Worthing, at the same time. And it got very dangerously near the hour when I hadn't been tested, but I should leave to get back to Worthing on the train to do this evening performance. Very dangerously close to the time I should leave, and it was foggy. So when I got into the studio to audition, they said to me, "Oh, we just want you to scream." Well, they heard me scream, all right, because I was at my wit's end.
Did you get the line right?
I screamed okay, but I was late for the theatre down in Worthing, and that is a crime, which is terrible, because the audience, the producer had to play music to the audience while they waited for me on the train to Brighton, and then the car to Worthing. A ghastly, ghastly time. Because in those days, we didn't have mobiles, you see. There's no way of communication as you sat on a train. Nothing you could do. So the audience...
You mean you didn't do what we all did back in those days, which is carry pigeons around?
Oh, did you?
Yeah, that's what I did. Yeah,
I haven't got mine with me that day.
Nah, I could have lent you one.
Anyway, I got the role because of the scream, because it was genuine. That's right. So then I got into that film, which was my first film. Freddie Francis was the director, very good lighting cameraman, but he was the director of this. And that was very cozy. It was a wonderful thing to do. Loved it very dearly. And you sort of, you feel you got your badge into film when you've done your Hammer Horror. You got a little badge. I've done my Hammer Horror film. But it was quite successful, I think. You know, people watched that, I hope, and liked it. And most of the role was screaming. No, I did have lines, of course I did. I had some lines to say. But there was a lot of screaming, too.
Shame they wasn't running down corridors, or you could have, you know,
oh, the
prepped
running
for future
down
roles
corridors.
If you were running down
yes,
corridors as
running
well.
Down corridors. Through those double doors in the Doctor Who film, slamming behind. Not everything didn't work when it should do with those Daleks coming down through those doors and us chasing or being ahead of them. It didn't always work. We had a lot of, you know, a lot of takes.
Accidents.
Takes, yeah.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, the Dalek insurance went up quite a lot in the 60s. People being bumped into by Daleks.
Yes, yes.
Right, we've got... Do we have any more questions from the audience?
No.
No more questions? Well, in that case, Jenny, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Ben, very much. And thank you very much for coming to listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jenny Lyndon. Thank you.
That... They'd already downsized Crabbe and Goyle's part, you know, because I'd read the first three, and you know, they do quite a bit more in the books than they do in the movies. So the books aren't really much to go by, because you might read something in the fifth one or the sixth one, which Crabbe and Goyle do, only to find out that it's not in the movie anyway. So you just go by the script, really.
Yes, there was never anything that really crossed your mind. Martin, obviously you were in Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Yeah, that's right.
As Scary Face.
Yeah, that's just sort of a little part that I had before
Are
that.
You...
Before that, I mean, I did the Batman film, which was Warner Brothers. And
yeah.
Before that, I did The Golden Compass, which was New Line Cinema, which is a variant of Warner Brothers. That's how I actually got involved with the Harry Potter films from the outset. I used to be in a TV series, you see. And
right.
I got my call up to do Golden Compass. I got really pally with some of the guys who were actually ADs, second ADs and that. They put me forward for the Batman film, which I then got. But I was doing a TV series called Kingdom at the time. And then because I'd done the Batman film, they wanted a big guy to play a character in Half-Blood Prince. I was on set on and off about 3 months. And I'm only on screen for a moment. So they asked me back, and they said, "We didn't use you enough. Would you like to come back and be in the last one?" At the time, it was just the one film. They hadn't decided to make it into Deathly Hallows Part 1 and 2. So we were filming it, and I think they said, "Oh, I think this is going to be Part 1," but we didn't know. And we were hoping I was going to come back to be in Part 2, but they couldn't get Andy Linden, who is actually Mundungus Fletcher, he wasn't available to do part two, so I never came back for part two. But that was great fun. I loved it. So
it's got to be annoying missing out on another role due to someone else not being available.
Well,
like Morecambe without
Wise. He was such a lovely guy, and we shared our own sort of dressing room slash tent, which is what they had there. And really good fun. And I'm only in a sort of relatively small role, but it's nice to be recognised for it and to do events like this and other Harry Potter events. But I do Batman events as well, so which is nice. So both franchises are very, very, very proud to be involved with both franchises, to be honest.
Had you read any of the books?
No.
So you weren't a fan at all?
No, not at all. No, I've got nothing against it at all. It's just I wasn't a fan personally, no.
You're not a wizardy person?
No, not at all.
Did either of you, I mean, I'm a bit blurry eyed from last night, but I'll stick to either of you. Either of you actually get to meet J.K. Rowling on set?
Yes. I met her when I was doing the Deathly Hallows. She tapped me on the shoulder, started chatting to me, which was not usually the done thing on set. And then I didn't realise it was her until after a few moments, that she was just talking about the scene.
I mean, that's got to be quite frustrating being in the last one, because if it was one of the earlier ones, you could have asked her what was going to happen.
Yeah, at that point, we were right at the end. So,
and, you know, tapped her up for a slightly bigger role down the line, you know.
So unfortunately, it wasn't an opportunity, no. So.
What about yourself, Josh? Did you get to meet the big JK?
I met her briefly at one of the premiere after parties. Can't remember, it's maybe the second or the third movie. It was just a passing hello, really. I was a little bit overwhelmed, you know. We locked eyes and I was walking towards her and we just said hi, and she said hi, and I wanted to stop and talk to her, but I felt like a little bit intimidated, like this is the creator of all of this, you know, and I kind of lost my bottle and just carried on walking.
But that's what people do when they see you normally, isn't it? So that must have been a bit weird being on the other side of that.
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, okay. So tell us about the filming process, because obviously, as we said, you were involved in all of them. Did the process of the actual filming change from the first one to the last one in respect of the, you know, what you had to do?
Well, no, not really. I mean, for certain sequences, we had like a lot of rehearsal time. Like for the Polyjuice Potion scene in the second movie, we had to do quite. Me and Jamie Waylett, who played Crab, we had to do quite a lot of preparation for that. Like, basically, for that scene that we had, they organised private screenings for me and Jamie and the acting coach, who was always there. She was always there throughout the whole of filming to help anyone with their lines or. Mainly the kids. So we had to go with her to the Warner Brothers like executive screening room in central London. 10 times they made us watch the first movie just to study Harry and Ron's body language, their mannerisms. So, come like after watching it for the 10th time, so we were so sick of it.
Did they provide popcorn every time?
Like, a bit. Huh?
Did they provide popcorn every time, or was it... Bring your own sweets.
I think they did, actually.
I should hope so.
I think that... Oh, no, actually, no, I don't think there was. No, that's... I'm thinking of the premieres. At the premieres, they'd always popcorn, but...
You had to take your own sweet.
But, yeah...
Hopefully you went to the pound shop and did what, you know...
Yeah, so we did that, and then they made us do, like, a couple of weeks of rehearsal where we had to rehearse the whole sequence. And then after that, when the dialogue slash acting coach, I think his name was Sandra, when she was happy with it... We had to do a show and tell in front of the producers, David Heyman and the director, Chris Columbus. A show and tell, so we had to perform the scene in front of them, so that they were happy with it. Like, no cameras or anything. And they liked it, and we shot it, and they kept it in the movie. So, yeah. I mean, they could have just like not filmed that sequence. I don't know how integral to the storyline that... I think it was quite important to the storyline. But, you know, it's Warner Brothers. They can get rid of really anything they like. I mean, they got rid of, you know, Rick Mayall filmed all his stuff. They filmed Peeves. Peeves was like a character. And they just cut him out. I can't remember why. There was a reason why. I think maybe the Americans wouldn't understand the humor. So, something along those lines. Either that or they just didn't like what he was doing. I don't know. But, so, I mean, they kept it in, and, I mean, they can do anything they want. They could have got rid of us and recast Crab and Goyle if they didn't think we was good, doing a good enough job. So, yeah, they liked it, kept it in, shot it, kept it in, and, yeah, we was happy. And also in the fourth movie, there's the Yule Ball. Now we did 2 weeks of, is it the Waltz? I think it's the Waltz. Rehearsing with the Waltz, and they brought in these professional dancers from dancing from big dance schools in London. We all got assigned a partner. 2 weeks doing this Waltz. And you don't even see me or Crab in that scene at all. Not even a glimpse. They're throwing away money because we wasn't really needed. We weren't even really needed in that scene, but they gave us the 2 weeks Waltz rehearsal anyway.
Would that be the strangest thing that you've had to do for something that has actually been pointless? I mean, because when you're doing your films, obviously you have to learn certain things for certain, like your Waltz there. Is that the thing that you spent most time doing that's actually not appeared on screen, or you've been on for 3 seconds and you could have just gone down your local discotheque, couldn't you? And
I mean, yeah, a lot of, and they, like I said, Warner Brothers, there's so much money, they're kind of throwing away money. I mean, I think my first few days to a week, it could have even been a week, my first days of shooting, I didn't shoot anything. So they'd pick me up at 6, me and my mum, with my chaperone, pick me up at 6, hair, makeup, costume, bomb, straight into tutoring. So I was there, I was like, kid, just about to get on set, really excited to do some filming, tutoring.
So you were all wearing your Harry Potter outfits?
Yeah, stay in costume.
Sat in a classroom.
Yep, so stay
learning
in costume.
Math. But you don't learn math, sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, you didn't really need me this week. You didn't need to pay me, like, or my mum, because the chaperone's got good money too, so they're paying the chaperones, paying for the hotel room. It wasn't needed. Like, I wasn't used the first week. But, you know, that's just big movies. That's just big studio films for you, you know.
Well, as you say, they've got to spend the money somehow. They make enough of it. What about yourself, Martin? Has there ever been anything that you've had to learn for a film that hasn't actually then been used in it?
No, not really.
Excellent.
No, I mean, I'll just echo what Josh was saying. A lot of the time it was just hanging around. In my case, obviously I wasn't being tutored, but I was sort of sitting in a big tent drinking coffee most of the days, especially on Half Blood Prince. And like you said, they pay you for the whole day, and then they treat you really well, and you wouldn't actually do any filming. Then you go back and come back, and then eventually they use you. So, but yeah, they have got so much money to play with, and they know that. And yeah, because they're onto a winner, really, because they're up to the, what, 6th, 7th film that I'm involved in. They know they're going to make so much money off the back of them. So yeah, they are quite flamboyant with the money, as it were. So, but no, I've never really had anything like that to worry about. Not like Josh has with his dancing. Yeah.
Oh, you never know. Strictly might come knocking in a couple of years' time. So, what have you got coming up in the future then? Anything, any projects that you're working on, or just about to be released? I know you've got a film coming up.
Yeah, a film called Come Away, which is a prequel to the Alice in Wonderland Peter Pan franchises. It's a crossover of the two as children. And we filmed that in Somerset House, and that's got Angelina Jolie, Michael Caine, amongst many others in it. And I play an ironmonger, and they've done a little nod to the Batman film, which is sweet. They've put me down Riddler's Walk, and like I said, yesterday, obviously new people today, but the director, the second unit director, is Mark Graysmark, who was the second unit director on the Batman film I was involved in, and same with this one. So they just wanted a little nod, which is quite sweet. So that comes out, I believe, next year. But I mean, that was probably about 2 years in post-production. So the actual filming wasn't that long. But it's just everything else afterwards is what takes the time. So that'll be coming out soon. Plus, I've done quite a few lots of documentaries for American TV, which is, there's an American base near where I live, and they've been using me for, I think I've done 5 now, so reconstruction type things, which are quite good fun. So I've been playing shady photographers, assault suspects. I think I played a guy called Kevin. So it's quite fun, and they just sort of use me. So I'm about 6 different characters in all these different documentaries. So, which is nice, because it's literally on my doorstep. So, which is nice. So I don't have to travel too far. But apart from that, that's it really for me. And lots of these shows.
These must be fun traveling around.
I love doing these. Yeah, I get to work with some lovely people, and I get to meet fans, which is nice. Always nice. So, yeah.
And yourself, Josh, what you got coming up? Obviously, you've had a little bit of a career change, stepping away from the camera and into the octagon.
I mean, when I had my first fight, the the once the, when the media got hold of it, it kind of went a bit viral, and you know, media being the media, they zhuzh things up a bit. They kind of made out like it was a career change and that I was now a pro fighter and that's what I was doing and I wasn't acting anymore, but that was never the case. It was just something I wanted to do. It's like it was just for myself. It wasn't to get any sort of media attention. It kind of got leaked. I don't know who leaked it, but somebody leaked it, which wasn't a bad thing. It actually worked in my favour that it went viral. But I'm an actor first, you know, and fighting's just more of like a hobby.
So what acting have you got coming up? Any roles that you've done coming out soon, or anything coming up that you haven't acted yet?
Yeah, I've got a small part in a new ITV drama, which is about, it's called Untitled NPX Project when I was filming it. It's a very hush-hush secret thing because it's a very touchy subject about the White House farm murders in Essex in the 80s. Jeremy Bamber basically massacred his whole family. And I've just a small part. And when I auditioned for six episodes, director liked me, but I wasn't right for the part. So they offered me this way smaller part. But, you know, as a job in actor, you can't really turn it down. It's a nice little, I've got a nice sequence in it. I don't know when that's being released. It was meant to be released in April, but they're sitting on it, I think, because they've got loads of big projects. I've got a couple short films. One is doing the festival run at the minute, I think. And one, I've got some reshoots to do at the start of September. And the one I'm really excited about, I've got my first lead role in a movie that shoots at the end of October called Cage Fighter, which ties in with sort of my fight experience as well, which is part of the reason I was chosen. I'm really hyped for that one. And just currently in preparation for that, lots of meetings with nutritionists and strength and conditioning coaches and MMA choreography. It's pretty tough, but it's got to be done.
I know one of you two was drinking water last night. Right, so let's throw it open to the audience. Anyone got any questions for either of these two? Come on then, I'll come down to see you two then. Getting old. Who wants to go? Do you want to go first? I'll walk round. It's all right. Don't worry about my hip. It's fine. I'll just hobble up here. You could have got closer to the stage. Go on then.
Hi, it's a question for Josh. You were obviously very young when you started the Harry Potter films. How did it affect your friendships? Did people, especially other children, did they treat you any differently?
Not my close friends. My close friends didn't. But yeah, some of the sort of the kids at school who were just like associates, you know, they would kind of they'd look at you a bit different and they would treat you a bit different. And the younger kids, they would, especially because it was 10 years we were filming, so it's throughout my whole time at secondary school. So I'd move up a year, year 9, year 10, it's the year 7s, the first years, it would be really annoying. And what they used to do is they'd shout from across the playground. They wouldn't even shout Gore. They'd just shout, "Oi, Harry Potter!" That was it. They'd just shout that. And like down corridors, they'd be, "Harry Potter!" And then they'd like run off laughing. That got a bit annoying. That's about not your close friend. Your close friend was, you know.
Lovely. Good question, by the way. All right, another question.
This is for Josh. I was just wondering, because as you met, like in the Harry Potter movies, you met Tom Felton. Is he different behind the scenes than he is in the movies?
Yeah, of course. He's not evil or anything. he looks evil. He's got real strong, really powerful, piercing blue eyes. Those kind of eyes which a lot of women like, but I actually find a bit uncomfortable, like maintaining eye contact with them. You can easily, if you was going on first impressions, you would just think he's nasty. But no, he's not. He's a sweetheart.
Have you kept contact with him as you spent so much time with him on there?
We lost contact for many years, 6 or 7 years. And then we just recently started talking again. I mean, we started messaging each other on Instagram, and he's got loads of fake profiles, but obviously he's got a tick. But there's two or three fake profiles for me as well. Obviously, I don't have a tick yet. I don't have enough followers. So he messaged me saying, is this the real Josh? I was like, yeah, man. And I told him a story which only me and him would know, something that happened off set. And he was like,
what happens on set stays on set, yeah?
Huh?
What happens on set stays on set.
Yeah, and what happened off set stays off set as well.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, no, yeah. So we swap numbers and we talk quite regularly now, which is cool.
Cool, cool. Right, another question.
Have you ever visited like the making of Harry Potter or the one in Universal Studios in like America?
I didn't hear all that.
Have you ever visited the Harry Potter place in, was it Hertfordshire or the one in America at Universal Studios?
I've done the studio tour in Leavesden, which was interesting. I enjoyed that. I've not done Orlando yet. Which I'd really like to do, but I mean I might be doing LeakyCon next year when they do an Orlando event. So fingers crossed that happens, and then I'll get to go for free.
Have you been to any of the ones?
Even better.
I've been to both of them multiple times.
The one in Orlando is rather good. I went 3 days after it opened, and there was a 3-hour queue for one of the rides. Somehow, me and my time 6-year-old daughter managed to dodge half of the queue, and we were on it in about 20 minutes.
Well, hopefully, if they do get me on the LeakyCon in 2020, that I'll get fast-track tickets.
It's a tough life, isn't it? Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together and say thank you very much to Josh Herdman and Martin Ballantyne.
Thank you.
Well, it's Doctor Who music again. I've heard this once or twice in the last couple of days now. We can now welcome to the stage artist extraordinaire Alistair Pearson. Alistair. Yeah, we can come down there, can't we? Because that way. Absolutely. We could just spin the chairs round and just... So, as there you go, welcome to
how are the acoustics?
Fantasy Con, sir. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, artist then?
Yes.
Tell us about. Yeah, I know it is getting a bit. Has anyone got any sun loungers? We could just kick right. But actually, we'll go outside into the courtyard.
We could.
Yeah. So yeah, artist, and you've been doing Doctor Who art for how many years now?
The first thing I had published was in 1980, probably know better than I do, 85, 4, 3, 2, 1, I don't know.
It was
a long time ago. It was a book called The Key to Time by Peter Haining, and it was published by W.H. Allen, who were doing the Target books at the time, and the idea was for fans to send in their own drawings and illustrations and things, and they made a choice, and they chose a couple of mine.
So that's how you got into it?
That's how I got into it initially. Not that I got paid for it. I know I got a free copy of the book, as I recall.
Well, that's good.
Save me a few pennies, yeah.
Free meal, yeah.
And I think based on the success of that, Doctor Who magazine started having an artwork page. Mm. People would send stuff in. So every month I'd run down to the newsagent and, oh well, there's always next month. And the next month I'd, because I'd sent in, oh no, I'm getting ahead of myself. I think the year or two after that, there was another book in the pipeline, and again they were asking people to send in artwork, and I think the book was called The Doctor Who File. And I thought, well, that sounds like some sort of A to Z type thing. And everyone's going to draw Daleks and Cybermen for the D and the C and all the rest of it. So there'll be a lot of competition for various letters of the alphabet. And I thought, well, no one's going to draw a mandrel, are they? And no one's going to draw the priest or whatever it is from Colony in Space. And no one's going to draw a bloody fish person and all that sort of stuff. So I did all the sort of the really naff things that I could think of.
Well, the obscure ones,
and I thought, well, it's a guaranteed way of getting my work in
print. Absolutely.
Well, the book wasn't any kind of A to Z, as it turned out, and not a single piece of anything I'd sent in appeared. But subsequently, when the magazine were asking for things, I sent off all these drawings as I had them returned. And finally, although they didn't actually use any of them, I suddenly had this letter out of the blue from Sheila Craner, who was the editor of the magazine, saying, I've got this huge pile of work which I'm going through, and I found yours, and I like it, and if you've got anything else, you can show me. And at the time, I'd been working on a painting of, we only had six doctors in those days, so a painting of all six doctors, and I took some photographs of that. I don't think it was finished at the time. And sent those in, and she said, fine, we'll finish that and we'll print it. Which they duly did. I look at it now and just cringe with embarrassment because it's so bad. It's
everybody cringes at their early work.
It looks like I painted it with an emery board. It's just so sort of, you know, crusty and speckly and dotty and awful. But that's, in terms of the sort of posters and things that DWM did, it all snowballed from that. And then with that work behind me, I'd been pestering W.H. Allen before that anyway. But with that sort of behind me, and some actually work in print, officially, properly.
Yeah.
But I was very lucky, you see. I think various things happened which may have had a bearing and may not, I don't know. I mean, for example, this is a good example. The day that I first went to W.H. Allen with a view to coming away with a book cover commission, I had to go to Marvel first thing in the morning, either to pick something up or drop something back, I can't remember which. And that very morning, the new logo, the McCoy logo, had come in the post from the BBC.
Right.
And they had a colour transparency about yay big, and a sort of simplified black and white version with sort of a cartoony chrome effect on the WHO, and that's the version they used on the magazine in due course. And they ran off a photocopy of that with me, for me. So when I got to WHO Channel later in the day, and we were chatting away with the art director and whatnot, I said, when are you going to start using the new logo? What new logo? Oh, well, this new logo. So here's this nobody from the Isle of Wight who's turned up sort of gives a job, you know, and he seems to know what he's talking about. And so that, you know, as it may have had a bearing, may not.
That's an incredible twist of fate, that, isn't it?
Well, it was. And I did come away with a commission, and it was The Underwater Menace. Hurrah! Of course, these days, with the internet and all the rest of it, I mean, there are hundreds of photographs you can go to for reference material and all that sort of thing. And I do find it very strange. There's an artist, I won't name him, a fan artist, who I've met a couple of times at events. And he's very good, and I like him a lot, and I like what he does, but he will use very well-known references of Tom or Peter Davison or whoever it is. And you think, well, yeah, but you could take the head from that and the body from that and do something else. It doesn't have to be that photograph copied exactly.
Well, yeah, otherwise it's just a photocopy, isn't it?
I had no excuse back in the day because, you know, Underwater Menace,
yeah.
I think there are 9 photographs from Underwater Menace. Time of the Rani, there are 3,000. So I think it's the most photographed Doctor Who story there is. And of those 9 photographs for Underwater Menace, I think only 3 of them had been in print at the time, back in 1980, whatever it was, and only one of them is not a fish people. So what was I going to paint, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that fish person and that fish person and that fish person.
Well, you had the choice of 3.
Yeah, I did. Well, I painted all 3.
Exactly, yeah.
Anyway, we've got some artwork here, which I brought along for the day.
Yeah, show us what you've got there.
For those of you who haven't yet bought a raffle ticket, we're doing a raffle today. The money is going to Colin's choice of charity, which is Tiggy Winkles, or St. Tiggy Winkles, which is an animal welfare charity. That is the original painting of Vengeance on Varos. The print that we're auctioning is exactly the same size as the artwork, up to and including the felt tip pen mark across the bottom. Signed by Colin. It's one of only 2 copies there are, and the other one is owned by Colin. So that hopefully is quite nice for someone to have. He's also signed for me today, as indeed has Chris. This is going to be raffled in November, again for Tiggy Winkles, at the screening in London for the new Sill DVD. Blu-ray.
Yeah, I read about that coming out.
Chris Barnfather is directing, and Sophie Aldred, and I think Chris is back, but not playing an alien this time. So, yes, we have various things like this. Again, you know, I look at them now, and yes, I remember that photograph being in DWM and what have you, but now I could go on Facebook in the photo research group, whatever it's called, and probably find, you know, umpteen different photographs that maybe hadn't been in print, or take, you know, a head from one thing and a body from somewhere else and create something new, but those weren't options back in the day.
Do you think that's taken the creativity out of art then, having so many new reference points easily available? Because as you were saying, back in the day, it was a case of what you could think or remember or what you could find, and if there wasn't a lot there, then obviously it's got to be something that you create, whereas these days, as there's a billion things to see, it is just like, you know, as you just mentioned with the other artist, copying a photo or just copying something. It's not being creative with it, is it?
Well, I think the artistry comes in what you do with it. I don't actually remember what... I remember this photograph being an inside cover DWM, you know, there it was. And it seemed ideal, and I liked it because it was slightly out of focus, so I painted it slightly out of focus. But I think, you know, what you do with it and all the rest of it, I was always very keen on using sort of set design details or colours and that sort of thing. I don't know. You're limited in some ways by your own imagination, probably, and I'm as guilty as that as anyone. I mean, that one, for example, which is Hartnell's last story, of course. I mean, that isn't a reference of him from that story. That's from Celestial Toymaker. And I'm sure he doesn't clean whatever he's cleaning with a hanky in 10th Planet, but never mind. This was a very fuzzy reference, as I recalled, which is why it's painted in a slightly weird way. That just came from a library book, The Earth. What the coloured background's all to do with, I don't really know. It seemed okay at the time. That's one reference flipped over and used again, just to give it a bit of a balance. What's on the back of that one? I've forgotten. Because the other thing that's an element of the modern day, as it were, is the digital domain, which is completely beyond me. I'm terribly old-fashioned. So things like this have been... tinkered with in recent years for various events. We did an art card version of this a few years ago where these sort of silhouettes were filled in by having that cloned. And we had a lineup of, I think it's four, like proper Daleks rather than all this nonsense. And I think the TARDIS was tinkered with a bit. And I always have my initials and names and other people's initials cleaned off on these things. So... It's interesting to go back to something that's 25, 30 years old in some case and putting it through this new process or taking again with this mind warp thing back here. I mean, the head of Colin is from a missing adventure called Millennial Rights. The body is from the Trial of a Time Lord video cover.
thought I recognised that, but...
So all these sort of bits and pieces come together to create, hopefully, something new and vaguely interesting. What have we got there? So on the back of there, we've got Ark of Infinity. There is a story behind that one, which I'm not sure I ought to tell, but I will.
I think we'll be all right.
Well, I'll
just check for kids.
Keep it to yourself. Yeah, when the video cover of this came out, I thought, excuse me? What's this? Because the video cover has this design on it, this eight-pointed star thing, which has nothing to do with the story at all. It was just my own way of keeping the Matrix background separate from the orangey background. So what's it doing on the video cover? By a different artist, I'm not going to name him. And he'd used it simply because he thought it was from the story. I thought, well, that's a bit lazy, isn't it? You could have checked, couldn't you? You could have watched the bloody thing or whatever, but no.
Could have seen what the word plagiarism means in the dictionary.
I made a little phone call. I said, excuse me. Yeah. could I just point out that, you know, and then I got another phone call, although I got a phone call back from said artist. And it was like a death threat or anything, daft, but he was not happy, and I thought, well, excuse me, you're the one who's, you know. Anyway, what can you do? What have we got here?
Tracking down, that's what I think we
should
do.
Well, the video cover, not video, DVD cover of this story is not a million miles away from what I did all those years ago, and supposedly the artist had never seen this before, who did the video cover.
Of course.
DVD cover.
Of course.
But yeah. Very, very similar colour scheme, and this, and I think it's the same reference of Broton. And you just think, oh, okay.
You got to wonder, haven't you?
Whatever.
But, I mean, that must be, well, obviously, firstly, annoying, but secondly, you must think, well, actually, take a bit of pride from that, in the fact that someone's obviously, well, not obviously, potentially seen what you've done and thought, yeah, that works, I'll
I am quite possessive of my
Well, everyone creative paintings. Is, isn't they? You know, if you make something, it's your baby, yeah. It's what you've done, and if someone else then rips it off, you've got to be a bit...
Yeah. I mean, I think people generally know that I don't sell prints of my work. That's something I've always been very anti. It's a rather unfortunate phrase of milking the fans. Could be misconstrued, I think, possibly. But and there are a couple of reasons for it, if I can talk about that. Was that some weird sound effect going on?
It's a sci-fi convention. Things sound one, funny all the time, don't they?
One is I think there's an inherent arrogance in, oh, I'll do lots of my prints of my work, and of course people want to buy them. Well, I don't have that assumption. It may be true. People do, you know, say to me on Facebook or events and things, oh, do you sell prints? And I say no, and they look disappointed. But I'd rather not do them and not have a stack of unsold things, which have cost me a fortune to have done. Yeah. So that's partly the reason. The other reason is, and again I won't name names because he's no longer with us, I was at an event many years ago and there was an actor there with, basically, it looked like photographs of himself he'd cut out of magazines and stuck down on bits of paper and then colour photocopied them. And he was charging whatever it was for a sheet, which he would then sign. And it was tat. Basically, it was absolute tat. And I was standing talking to him because, rather bizarrely, we shared the same dentist, and which actually gives a bit of a clue as to his identity because he lived on the island. And this was up in London. And this guy turned up, and whether he didn't see the prices or something, I don't know, but he said, oh, I have one of those. And then the actor was... didn't actually have his hand out in a sort of, well, come on then, where's your money, sort of attitude, but there was obviously this sort of, where's my money then? And this guy was sort of patting his pockets and fumbling in his bag. He didn't have the cash. And I was just standing there, and this actor was sort of, well, come on then. He wasn't actually saying that or doing that, but that was the sort of body language. And this guy was just, you know, he was red, he was sweating, and he was just looking so uncomfortable. And I thought, I wouldn't do this to anybody. If it was me, I'm quivering, but if this was me in this situation, I'd say, you know what, have them on me, have a nice day. Or I'd put one back, or put them all back, or just have one, or whatever. I would deal with it in a nice way. I wouldn't just stand there going, dollar signs in the eyes. And I thought, I never ever want to put anybody in that situation. So that's another sort of reason. And... basically, the other is a sort of anti-arrogance thing in a way. There's a line in The Two Doctors where Oscar says, like the star on my dressing room door, it's conspicuous by its absence, or something. And I like the fact that out of the, you know, the Achilleses and the Cummins and the Skeleters and the Howards and all the rest of it, I'm the one person you can't buy a print from. I'd much rather do an event up down the country, wherever, with a one-off print signed by a couple of people for charity, and make it something, dare I say, special, rather than... and the other thing is, this doesn't come from me personally, other people I've been at events with other artists selling their work, their prints, and people come up to me and say, it's not very good quality paper, or it's not what this or it's not that, and I think, well, I'm buying it then. You know, so
well, that's all there we are. What's the favourite? Have you got your favourite piece of Doctor Who?
I don't have my favourite painting here. I think everyone knows what it is because I'm always wittering on about it. My all-time favourite story is The Leisure Hive. I don't know why. I do know why. I was, 16 or something when it was first broadcast. And although I look back now at season 17 and enjoy the storylines and all the rest of it, it just looks so cheap and awful and tacky and dreadful. And The Leisure Hive turned up and just, wow, and that was a great age to be, you know, a very impressionable age and a great age to be sort of knocked back by something. And I was just completely blown away by it. So the painting I did for the book cover is my favourite. And I pestered Michael Stevens at BBC Audio for years, saying, when you do a Leisure Hive, you've got to use mine, you've got to use mine. And he finally relented, and they did use mine, which I was very happy about. And my hardback copy of the book is signed by David Fisher, and I've got a copy of the script, and I've got a copy of the studio floor plan, and this, that, and the other, which somebody gave to me. Unbelievable. So, yeah, that's just my favourite story ever, and it's my favourite painting that I've ever done.
Excellent.
Doctor Who-wise. I wish I had a tissue, because my nose is running. This is very embarrassing. Anyone got a tissue?
Anyone? No.
No.
We've had a waft of Doctor Who dry ice. Oh, a waft more. Oh, I see why. Ladies and gentlemen, it's our second Doctor Who panel of the afternoon. Would you please welcome to the stage, we have Leela I've been practicing this, Shabalala. I'm going to do that again. Leela Shabalala. Can I call you V? We have the lovely Jenny Linden. Hello, my darling.
Oh, was I supposed to come out there? Sorry.
You can do it again. Do it again. I'll tell you what. I'll do David first. Firstly, it's David Finn. And Leela Shabalala. Well, you can sit where you want. I don't mind. I mean, I can obviously understand whoever wants to sit furthest away from me. That's quite understandable. So, welcome.
Hello.
To day two of FantasyCon. How's it been for you? Are you enjoying yourselves? How are you finding the weather in the island?
Yes.
There was a lot of questions. Absolutely. There. You can break it down if you want. Do one at a time.
What was the question?
How are you doing?
Oh, very well, thank you, Ben. How are you?
I'm very good, thank
you. Good.
Bit tired.
Is everybody out there very well or hot? Everybody out there. It's a big number.
Yeah, what it is a lot of people have come in fancy dress and a lot of people have come as seats. I think that's what it is, the blue seats. So let's run through the panel, shall we? V,
yeah.
You were in The Next Doctor.
I was.
And you played Rosita.
Mm-hmm.
And you were fantastic.
Thank you.
And at one point, I thought you were going to be the next Doctor.
Oh, I know Russell T. Davies done it so cleverly. David Tennant was just about to leave, as we all know, and the next Doctor came. So obviously, everyone was thinking, oh, is it David Morrissey? Yeah, who's it going to be? Is this the new assistant? And he was also very clever to name Rosita. So people were asking, is that any kind of connection with Rose? So it was really well done, and it kept everyone guessing. But I was saying in the panel yesterday, it was very difficult to keep my mouth shut, which I find very difficult on a daily basis. But we filmed in March, April, and I had to be quiet all the way up to December when it shut. Yeah, and the press are very clever, asking questions, trying to trip you up, find out what's going on. So as soon as the episode aired, I was, thank God, I was really relieved. But yeah, it was an amazing experience. It was so difficult, months and months of, you know, being very careful of what I said, what I could say and not say.
Not giving anything away.
Mm.
And we obviously have Jenny with us from Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Absolutely right.
The movie from 1965, which was -10 for. I didn't see it at the cinema, if we're being honest. I did see it on telly, though.
Yes. And several times.
Especially around Christmas.
Yeah.
Easter.
Yes.
August. New Year. Yeah. It does. That must be good. Great seeing it on telly quite a lot. It must. Hello. I think that was someone over there, actually. I think we're in the clear. I think we're all right. So you were Barbara in that, weren't you?
What, darling?
You were Barbara.
I was Barbara.
And how did that come about then?
Let's think. Let's just say I'd been in a television or something. I can't remember, actually. What I didn't have to do was do a test for it or audition for it. So this director, Gordon Fleming, must have seen me in something and thought, oh, that's Barbara, as they do. So I just went along to play this wonderful role. I didn't really know much about Doctor Who, I have to be honest with you, which is a good thing when you're making a movie or something that's so popular. It's a good thing not to know anything about it. So we'd got wonderful Peter Cushing and wonderful Roy Castle, little Roberta Tovey, and myself, and we all got on very well, and it was a very happy experience. But I do know it's not totally popular. I know that, and I can see why. You mustn't make any comparison to the television Doctor Who, because it was never intended to be the same thing. It was about colour, it was about comedy, and it was about action, but no violence. So this was a Swiss Family Robertson stuff, and it wasn't meant to be compared with the brilliant TV stuff. And also, of course, the colour. That was the first. A first, yeah.
First in widescreen, filmed by the BBC.
Oh, yes.
And first in Technicolor.
Eastman colour, was it? Eastman Technicolor?
Yeah, Eastman Technicolor. You have to say it like that.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to say Technicolor. It's got to be Technicolor.
Technicolor.
Hey, yes, look at that.
Okay.
And at the end there.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Long way away.
Hello.
How are you? Of course, you've done loads of things. Loads. Including Doctor Who, obviously.
Yes.
Which is why you're all sat on the Doctor Who panel.
Yes.
I thought there might be a reason. It was the Pandorica Opens, was it, Ewan?
Pandorica Opens, yeah.
First, and how did that come about then? Because, again, that was a...
Just an old school audition. And I think they were looking for a bit of comedy, because he's a bit of a dork, the character, and I think they wanted someone who would look funny running up a hill, getting out of breath, in a Legionnaire's outfit. So a fat guy running up a hill is always funny.
If you'd have seen me walking up from the port earlier.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
Exactly
the same thing.
Walking up a hill badly.
And I've got a lot of friends and family in Cardiff because I went to school there.
Yeah.
And I met up with some friends the night before. And one of them decided to give me a terrible dead leg, as you do when you meet up with your old school friends.
Oh, of course.
And if you look carefully, I'm actually limping up the hill. Because my friend decided to smash me in the leg the night before, yeah.
Well, that's good friends,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's what you decided.
They weren't helping you with your lines.
Yeah.
They weren't helping you with your staging. Instead, they're beating you.
Yeah, we're going to hurt you and make you look ridiculous on the biggest TV show in the world.
Oh, that's very good of them. Are they still friends?
Yeah.
We'll have words after.
Yeah.
I think we'll
have... You've got to keep those friends around. They keep you real, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah, so keep your friends close and your enemies... In France,
yeah.
I think is probably a good place to go. So, just the one Doctor Who episode for
you.
So, yeah, was it through your agent then? They just said, do you want to come
through
down?
Through agent, yeah. Got on really well with the director. Fat guy running up a hill is hilarious. And the rest is history.
Yeah. Fair enough. What about you, V? How did you get the role? Was it an audition for you as well? Or?
Yeah, it was an audition. A good friend of mine, Debbie Chazen, she was in the Doctor Who special the year before.
Right.
And cut long story short, I'm not sure if
we've got an hour. Don't pass the wrist.
So I think it starts, isn't it?
It's like Ghostbusters crossing the street.
But so Debbie was off doing the Doctor Who the year before. Obviously, I was really envious, very happy for her at the same time. But then I got the audition for the Doctor Who the next year, and apparently someone from Doctor Who, I think it was Andy Pryor, had seen myself and Debbie in a sketch show that we used to do. So obviously the role of Rosita came up, and they remembered me from then and thought, oh, okay, we'll get her in for an audition, and yeah, that was it.
Okay, so how was the filming process on that? Because obviously it was an hour-long special, wasn't it? So
yeah.
Was it any different from anything you've done before?
Yeah, it was. So it was an hour-long special. We were shooting for 4 weeks, which is crazy. But I remember the first day really clearly, and I got out of the car. We were filming in Cardiff. Yeah, the first couple of weeks were in Cardiff. So I got out of the car. And it was really surreal because they were filming down this really tiny kind of alleyway which they had hidden from the public, and they literally like pulled back this massive like curtain thing, and there was this instantly transformed into Victorian England. So I was just standing there completely in awe. There was so much going on. And David Tennant was lovely. As soon as he saw me, he came running over, just gave me a massive hug and welcomed me, because obviously I was standing there looking really cool, like,
What's going on here? Yeah.
So he was nice. David Morrissey came over as well, welcomed me, and I just had such a good time. I just remember laughing a lot. They were just really funny because they've known each other for years. They used to do Blackpool together, and they were just telling me loads of stories, making me laugh, and it was great. But, yeah, I had such a good time.
Does David Tennant speak in his Scottish accent when he's not filming?
When I first met him, I was like, why is he doing that accent? I completely forgot he was Scottish. And I was like, he's really nice, but a bit weird. But then I remembered, he actually is Scottish, but does a fantastic English accent.
Because there are people, there are actors who will just stay in character. Once they've walked through the set, they're just in that character the whole time. And I've always wondered if David was one of those.
No, he just talks in his normal accent. He's really good, though. If you're ever doing any like running scenes and stuff, he's there doing star jumps and things like that. And he really put me to shame, because we'll be doing night shoots, be about 4 a.m, and I'll just wait till the, said to get in your positions. I'll be sitting there moaning about the cold, and he's like, come on V, let's do some star jumps and all this. And I'm like, no, Dave, you're all right, can't bother. But he's great. He's just, what you see is what you get with him, because they say never to meet your heroes. Not true about David at all. Both Davids, Derbla Cohen as well, absolutely lovely. Like how they come across when you see them in interviews and on TV, they're like that all the time. They were so nice, really lovely people.
So it was a big production, because it was obviously the Christmas one. And a four-week shoot. I mean, a lot of that would have probably been spent sitting around not doing a lot then, I'm guessing. Because that's
Yeah.
How would you fill your time when you do? When you're
eating. The budget, the food was amazing.
Eating. What do you eat? Lettuce.
No, seriously.
They had like the eating.
No, they got me running around a lot, so it's fine. But I made such a big mistake my first day of filming. They said, go and have your breakfast. And they had, just a layout of, amazing food. Obviously, I stuffed my face, which is a really stupid thing I did, because I was literally lying on my trailer floor, gasping for air, undone the top button of my jeans and everything. And then 2 seconds later, there was a knock on the door. Val, we need to get you into your costume. And they had me corseted up. I was leaning against the wall, really trying hard not to throw up, thinking serves you right.
Yeah, but free food always tastes better, doesn't it?
It does. Free food and forbidden food.
Yeah, absolutely. Free pizza.
But another thing that I used to love doing, if I had spare time, I used to just love watching the two Davids on sex. They had loads of scenes together, and I'll just sit there just in awe. They were brilliant.
Now, yours was a big production episode, but David, yours was a massive production episode.
Yeah.
And tell us about the filming of that. And,
it was it's quite intimidating when you arrive in a field and they've made it look like a Roman kind of legion have made camp there for weeks. Mm. But I remember walking up and the first thing that hit me was the smell, because they had campfires lit. And I don't even think in any of the shots you see the campfires, you just for the smoke and for the authenticity. Everyone's in costume and everyone's got very precise movements and kind of, but the scale of it was amazing. And then up on the hill that I had to run up, waddle up. Should I say.
You did a fine sprint, sir.
Yeah.
Reminded me of Seb Coe.
Was
now, not then.
At the top of the hill was the TARDIS. And, we see them at these things and stuff, but when you see the real one on set, there's just that kind of heritage, the history that comes with that. It's one of those moments as an actor, you're like, yeah, this is special. This is really special.
I mean, we had a question for the last panel, which was something along the lines of, what do you do when you meet someone famous?
Yeah.
Now, the TARDIS is a very famous character.
Yeah.
Not too many lines over the years, apart from in the one episode, apart from the...
Yeah.
So was it that like that for you when you came on, you know, when you're filming your first scene?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we touched on this yesterday.
I'd gone by then.
You get imposter syndrome. So when you're going through those big moments, it's a case of kind of just telling yourself, just be cool, don't freak out, just be cool. They'll never know.
I am an actor.
Yeah.
We're getting feedback there.
And I've had it with anyone that I've admired. It's not really famous people that do it for me. It's when you meet people that you admire. Yeah. I remember I did a play, and there's an actor that I was at the National Theatre, and there's three theatres there, and there was another actor in another show there called Simon Russell Beale, who's generally regarded as one of the greatest living stage actors, and I've seen him in everything, grown up watching him, he's a hero. And he was in a different play, and we used to pass each other in the corridor every night. And every night he'd go, evening, and every single night I'd be like, and I'd try to say something, but nothing would come out. So it's just those moments where you're just like, just be cool. And being on set for this was very much one of those. It's a blag. The whole thing is a blag. Everything. Everyone, any actor that comes across as cool, they're blagging it.
They're acting.
They're faking it.
It's like it's a job for them or something, isn't it?
And they're riddled with self-doubt. Yeah. I guarantee it.
So the one person who's travelled in the TARDIS, probably more than you two, I'd say. Yeah, well, definitely, yeah. Jenny.
Yes.
It was an old TARDIS. A different style TARDIS.
I've signed that TARDIS. I mean, my signature is inside there.
Well, this weekend or before?
This TARDIS, all right, yes. But there was another TARDIS which was found in a church with hymn books in it. And it was rescued, it was mended, it was redecorated, restored, and they gave me the key. Now, you tell me where this TARDIS is now. I've got no idea.
Where's the key, more importantly?
Yes, I got the key.
You had the key. It was your responsibility. You lost the TARDIS.
Absolutely, David. Yeah. I thought, is this key valuable? Oh, it might be valuable. I'll keep it. Mm.
But the filming techniques must have been very different back when
and David talking about the theatre. In my time, I worked with an actress called Evelyn Lay, which you're all too young to know. She was called Boo Lay. And I was in a play in London with her. And the thing is, you could never address an older, mature actor or actress by their first name. So it was, good evening, Miss Lay, every time. Until she said, Boo to my friends was the title of her book. She said, call me Boo. Then you can do that. And I was in the same play, which had a film actress called Joan Bennett in it. And Joan was immaculate. You know, she'd got this amazing black, dark hair, amazing makeup, beautiful woman. And every night I crossed the stage to get out of the stage door, and I said, good night, Miss Bennett. And one night she smiled at me, and she had forgotten to put her teeth in. That was amazing, because she was so stunning.
Smoke and mirrors. Smoke and mirrors, mate.
But in America, they do have, a lot of them have, all their teeth taken out.
Yeah.
So they have the full white false ones.
Yeah.
But it was such a shock. And I could hardly say, good evening, Miss Burr, in it. I mean, it was amazing. But hadn't times changed? I mean, imagine now an actress or actor demanding to be called Mr.
Yeah.
Or Miss and their surname. Isn't it odd?
Well, I demanded it here, and it was obviously completely ignored. Now, this is something I haven't had to do for, about 3 years now. We're going to have to take a quick break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Oh, you got a... Oh,
we're back. We hope you enjoyed those adverts. Were there any adverts? Should we pretend there were adverts? It was the talcum powder one I was most taken by. So we are back here. Sorry about that short break we had to take there. It was
I needed a toilet.
Yeah, so did I. And a cheese sandwich. That's what it was. Let's talk Doctor Who again then. Were you a fan before you actually got the part?
I love Doctor Who, yeah. I watched it when I was really little. I just remember the Daleks used to just give me nightmares, and my mum used to stop me watching it. But I started watching it again when it got brought back.
Yeah.
And it was so exciting. I'll never forget actually sitting there watching it.
It was,
and
wasn't
literally,
it?
Yeah. And I remember I watched I can't remember what episode it was, but I was watching it a week before I went off to film, and it was just so surreal thinking, I'm going to be in this. Like, next week I'm going to be on the set. And David Tennant sounds biased, but he's one of my favourite doctors. And I'm so glad that I got to do the episode just before he went as well. That was, yeah,
don't
great.
Don't tell Colin.
Colin knows I love him.
Shh, but I love Colin.
He photobombed me yesterday.
What, really?
Yeah, I was trying to get my picture by the TARDIS, and he was in there in the back. He's a naughty man, so I put it on Instagram, got my own back.
Well, it's like sitting in someone else's car having your photo taken, isn't it? I mean, if he wants to pop his head in, then it's certainly allowed to. So you watched it, the classic series, and when it came back as well.
Yeah.
That time...
I watched the new series a lot more, obviously. I don't have too much maybe the old one, but the new ones, watching a lot more avidly, yeah.
Were you, you said there, kind of excited when it was coming back in the build-up to the first episode?
Yeah,
because I had that episode a couple of days before it actually was on telly, because I was working in media at the time, so I managed to get hold of
it. Oh, you saw it beforehand?
I saw it 2 days before it was actually on telly.
No way, yeah. That's amazing.
And it was like... Wow, and Adam, who sorted all this out, you know, I was on the phone to him telling me how good it was and all that stuff.
So good, amazing.
Can I have a look? No.
No.
But it was, wasn't it? It was the build-up to the return of it was...
immense. It was amazing. And Russell T. Davies, he just done, you know, such a good job just bringing it back. And, it's just so lovely that it was brought back again. And then, obviously, the younger generations, obviously, there's the old series that you could see, but then to bring it back again... new for the younger kids to watch now as well. It's just, living on for such a long time now. It's a legacy. It's amazing.
Were you a behind-the-sofa watcher, David, when you were younger?
Yeah, I remember my parents watching old episodes, and it was terrifying. Because also, it wasn't in the style of the things that we were watching at the time, so there was something otherworldly about that was even more scary. Something about the kind of now kind of limited effect. Like the Daleks, they were terrifying.
Yeah, for what they were.
Just absolute destruction, yeah. It's just the idea of that to a 4 or 5-year-old just kind of, terrifying.
Being scared that they're going to turn up. But the good thing was, obviously, when I was young at my age of 40 for middles, it was one of those cases that when you were asleep in bed at night, you knew you weren't going to get got by the Daleks because at that point they couldn't climb the stairs.
That's true.
So as long as you had anything more than a bungalow, then you were going to be all right.
Yeah.
So you had no problem. Now, obviously, Jenny, you were in it right at the start of 65, so they've started in 63. So a couple of years into Doctor Who on telly, you did the film. Did you carry on watching, or were you watching the...
No, not really. I wasn't really watching Doctor Who a lot. I knew it was on, I knew it existed, but I was a little older than go behind the sofa and watch that. As I said, have I said this before? It's better not to know. If you're doing a movie which was so different, the Daleks weren't meant to be terrifying. They were meant to shoot fire, and then they were reduced to fire extinguisher steam. I mean, they began to be more comical than frightening in our films. Totally different. It wasn't frightening in that way at all. And I'm full of admiration for the way that Ray Cusick designed them to his little 6-year-old, and he made them out of cardboard and lavatory bits, really, plungers and ball cocks and all that stuff, and it was stunning, and they just copied it and made it this big. And so no, they were never frightened. I didn't have a fear of time. I didn't. So it's all very different in our film. It can't be compared at all.
And did you not watch after you'd been in the film? Did you not think, oh, hold on a minute, there's a scene?
I did. I certainly did a few of them. I watched Peter. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Peter.
Too many Peters, too many doctors.
Sorry. Blank.
Too many Bakers.
His work. I liked his work very much indeed. And I liked Tom Baker's work on it. And the other one, Eccleston, I thought
yeah,
he was,
Chris Eccleston.
He didn't stay very long, but he was a very interesting doctor.
I think personally, a lot of people will probably agree that it's a shame he didn't stay longer.
Mm.
You know, two or three series of Christopher Eccleston would have really, I think, cemented the character back into, you know.
I think he perhaps didn't want to get known as one character.
I think that's what it was, wasn't it? Mm. I think he said he didn't want to get typecast.
Yeah, yeah.
They hadn't offered him a new contract or something by the time, and then he didn't, and then he couldn't, and then he wouldn't, and then he shouldn't, and then. Yeah. But if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have had David Tennant.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it wasn't for David Tennant, we wouldn't have had you in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
There we go. So everything happens for a reason.
Every cloud has a silver lining.
But, can I be an old grumbling woman?
I very much doubt it.
You know, I tell you something. I think David Tennant's a very good actor, but when we were training as actors, if there was an accent to be played, to be acted, you had to give what they called a flavour of it only, because sometimes it's sold to the American market. They can't get it. We knew that. Like the Saint, they took enormous trouble. You really had to be very clear. And sometimes you'd shoot a scene twice, one for the American market and one for the English market. Yeah. So we had much more concern with people actually understanding what was being said. Now, I don't want to pick on David, but the things that are happening today is that these actors are doing what their full accent or dialect from where they live, only very few people can fully understand. And the people I talk to are having, what do you call it? Yes, thank you, darling. Subtitles. I mean, that's incredible. When I think from my point of view, to have subtitles to your work. Sorry, that's a grumbly old woman, but I know it's happened, and I just think, that's sad.
Well, it is, but subtitles are appearing on more and more programs that, you know, just because of an accent on
Yes.
Which...
It doesn't make sense to me. Does it to you, David? David?
Pass the buck. I can see why you'd have to maybe soften it sometimes. But I also don't think you should pander to the American market. They should just work harder.
Well, it's called money, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're buying it.
Yeah. That's the problem, isn't it? Where it comes
from. They're not buying it.
Yeah, that's it.
If they're not understanding, then... But maybe everything should just be done in American accents. That way, both markets are capable.
But do you find it sometimes difficult to follow an American movie, CD you're playing at home?
Well, you would do, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
you
know, it is hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially with all the different kind of accents anyway.
It's all like that anyway, and all blurred.
Talking a bit too
fast. Oh, there, darling. It's all blurs, doesn't it?
Can't get what they're saying sometimes. It's never good, is it? Sorry, spell
I had Catherine Hepburn say, I did a test with Peter O'Toole for Lion in Winter, and I did it quite well, and Peter said, see you on the set, kid, which was lovely of Peter O'Toole. And then Catherine Hepburn saw the test, and she said, there's only one person who cries in this movie, and that's me. I lost it, but I got another film instead.
That's a good Catherine Hepburn.
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, doesn't it? Yeah. Do you do anyone else? Do you do anyone else?
I can do. Mae West. Mae West. Now, I'm going to get there. You know, Mae West said I've sat on more laps than napkins.
This is something we haven't done yet this weekend. We could have been doing impressions the whole time. David, have you got any? Please don't say no.
Okay, maybe a De Niro face.
Oh.
You're good, you.
Is the chair uncomfortable or something?
And of course, there's James Corden as well. Talks up here, doesn't he? James Corden, yeah. It's all breathy. Oh, yeah, like me, yeah.
That's not bad, actually. Yeah. Could you do that running up? And MV, what about you?
I haven't got anything. I'm sorry.
I'm Batman.
That's about all I can do. That was really rubbish.
I don't know, was that a Superman film?
I said Batman.
Exactly.
Listen.
Oh, sorry. Right, so we've talked about, how you got into Doctor Who, that you liked it before. When it comes to actually fans of other sci-fi, what other things, obviously, David, you've been in several different, not just sci-fi things, but, you know, when it comes to that, what are your other interests, science fiction-wise?
other interests.
Yeah.
I really like the Wheel of Time book series.
Right.
Which Amazon are making into a massive production as we speak.
How much do you like it? Have you got a part in it?
I haven't.
Have you asked?
I haven't been seen for it.
I have.
Because I'm... Have you?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
it's the long hair.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Because I'm shooting a TV show in Canada in March that clashes, so I couldn't go for it, so I was quite gutted. But I read it when I was 19, 20, which is the perfect age for one of the leads, but now I'm 36, and I'm way too old for any of those parts now I have to come to terms with. But that's a brilliant... it's like Game of Thrones. If Game of Thrones was a pile of books that high, Wheel of Time is like this. It's just so dense, so much. It's brilliant. Big sprawling world.
I thought you were going to say big sprawling words on the page. Yeah. You've got so many more books.
And I like, I really like Asimov as well.
All right, okay. Yeah. And yourself, V?
Oh, I loved Quantum Leap. Sorry, Eastern girl. Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap.
I can't
find
Quantum Leap, are you? 2 for 1 on Friday nights, isn't it?
I loved that series so much.
Old Sam.
Yeah. Oh, it was amazing. And Misfits, I really liked that. Would you say the sci-fi? I don't know. What do you think? Yeah. Actually, we've got a nice little part on Misfits, and I have a record for that program, and that was the most short-lived probation officer in the whole series. In the whole of Misfits.
Yeah.
I said, I'm your probation officer. Then I got eaten by a zombie cheerleader. As you do.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. And I died, yeah.
How many days are you on set for that?
Oh, and then I woke up, actually. And then I got my face smashed in with a baseball bat. Just to make sure I wasn't coming back as a zombie myself.
All right,
that was fun.
That's an interesting way to go, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Twice.
And Jenny, what about yourself when it comes to, well, maybe, you know, science fiction?
What was the question, darling?
Science fiction, other TV serials, you like, what kind of things are you into?
I didn't do much science fiction.
The things you've watched
on telly, but
like.
I did lots of other things.
Well,
like
you've done a million
Avengers
things.
Avengers the Saint. You know, you're called in our day, you're called a guest artist, which is very nice because you get special billing. And so I did Avengers, Saint, Persuaders. Then in my day, you had a play on Wednesday night, which Robert knows about, and you had a play on Saturday night, and I was often in a Wednesday night and a Saturday night play. They were different plays, different stories, not necessarily science fiction or anything like it. You had a, you know, I was, what was called at one time, I was very fortunate, I was called Flavor of the Month, that's what you call, if you were doing lots of telly. But I was very fortunate because I did telly, I did West End, I did film, radio, and a musical. So I was very fortunate because we had structure. See, the young don't get structure today. We had practice in reps. We could go to the rep theatres and practice every part of the theatre. And so we had a sort of training and a structure. Well, now the young people don't have a structure at all. We used to get work because we used to learn that you're as good as you did last night. So you've done a performance for play, that's how good you are. Then the next day you've got to do better, really, to keep up with it. So I don't think the young have a fair crack at the whip because their experience is television mostly, and it'll be mostly soap as their first experience. So when they ask the kids from the soaps to do a play, they haven't learnt to project. And you know, it's sad. It's sad. The training isn't there.
I mean, it has all changed, hasn't it? Because years ago, it was a case of normally coming through the acting world via the stage onto the telly. Now, these days, all you have to do is appear on TOWIE or something like that. Oh, yes, yeah. They're very talented people, aren't
they're
they?
They're amazing. I'm an actress.
Oh, they're
there. You're
and they can sing, too. Oh, yeah. So when it comes to parts that you'd like to play, fantasy parts, if you like, What's the character? What film is it? And if it's a film, you know, one of your favourite films, what character would you like to play in that film? If it's a book that's never been made into a film, again, what character would you like to play ultimately? What would be your complete fantasy character to play?
I haven't got an actual character, like, in an actual character from a film,
But I think anything involving action, like in a Bond film, anything where I'm shooting and running up hills and fighting.
Yeah, I can help you with that.
Well, but going up the hill slowly, but you can anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything like that, but...
So you want to get a role in The Fast and the Furious?
Yeah,
or something like
so, oh God, they're on about number 27 now, aren't they? How many is
46.
It been?
46.
They've stopped actually saying the number of the film now, haven't they? Because they've gone too far. It's like Tokyo Drift. Yeah.
They've started giving them Latin names so they can actually have more.
But I'd also like to kind of go back to my roots and play something. It'd be nice to, you know, find out about a character in history from Africa. So something quite, you know, heavy like that would be amazing. I'd love to do that.
Okay, yeah, cool. Definitely. Go on then, Jenny.
What character?
What character? In everything you've seen, would you have liked to have played?
Mine's going to be so old-fashioned.
Doesn't matter.
I would have loved to have played in Sound of Music. That film.
You wanted to be Julie Andrews.
Oh, it would have been bliss.
But it wasn't the right time.
I couldn't do it like her. It was just the wonderful time in the theatre, and that's my wish, but it's gone. It's okay.
Well, we can still make it happen.
Plenty of time, isn't there? Yeah, that's what you were saying, yeah.
If only Cilla Black was still with us, we could have had surprise, surprise.
I could do, what are we going to do about Maria? What are we going to do, la la la? Couldn't I?
And David, moving swiftly on, Jenny. What about yourself?
Mine's a bit of a mixed bag. I'd love to play Jean Valjean in Les Mis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Bit of a singer as well, are you?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've done a few musicals, yeah.
School of Rock, maybe?
What's that?
School of Rock, maybe?
Yeah, I did School of Rock. I was the original Dewey Finn in the West End, yeah, the Jack Black role. I'd love to play Joe Keller in a play called All My Sons by Arthur Miller.
Oh,
it's my favourite American play. Right. And Joe Keller, he's in his 50s and 60s, so I've got some time. And I think I've got a Henry VIII in me in a TV adaptation.
I wondered what that was coming out the back.
Yeah, I think I've got Henry VIII in me somewhere. Ginger beard. Yeah.
Why Henry VIII?
I just think because he's such an interesting character, and he had such a massive, probably more so than any royal, huge influence on the course of history in terms of splitting a church into two, which has now kind of gone down so many different... You know, it's split again and again and again. And also just the whole business with the wives is mental. I saw Six, the musical, the other night, which is told from the perspective of the six wives. And I just think it's a really interesting story. And to mine his kind of, his thinking and his, because there's obviously a huge ego and dysfunction there. And for me, that's the interesting stuff as an actor, to kind of find that and what that is and make him human. And not just a tyrant who just chops off his wife's heads, but try and find the human being in him.
Yeah, I think.
And also because he's fat and he's got a ginger beard, so I can do it. Yeah.
You're not fat.
Not fat, you know,
about?
Bit of padding. And Ray Winston.
You'd have to have a lot of padding, mate. I've got a lot you can borrow. But...
And Ray Winston was the last person to do it on TV, and he just kind of. There's a floating head there.
Hello.
You do see some strange things.
Just a floating head, unicorn as well. And Ray Winston was the last one to do it on TV, and he was like, oh, Cockney, like, I love you, Ed. And I was like, I'd love to get in there and just give it a bit of regality and
I love you, Anne.
Yeah, that's it. There you go.
Speaking of All My Sons and a Doctor Who connection, actually, I saw it, All My Sons, about 3 months ago at the Old Vic. Jenna Coleman.
Sally Field.
Bill Pullman. Amazing.
I did it. It was my first theatre job. I did it at the Leicester Curve Theatre. I just played a small part in it, but I used to stand in the wings every night and watch the old ones do. Do it properly. Do it right.
You're rare. The young don't go to see the older ones because I asked them.
Yeah.
They haven't seen it, so thank you, David.
Oh, that's all right.
Well, that's just where they get all the experience from, isn't it? You've got to pass it down.
Yeah. Well, we used to go and stand in the theatres at the back, and every penny we got we spent on theatre looking at the olders doing it. Lovely. But they don't do it today.
They don't have the time, do they?
No.
Too busy appearing in TOWIE. So what have we all got coming up? I say we all, like no one cares, like what I've got coming up. A ferry at 4:15, probably. But what have you got coming up then? Anything in the pipeline, anything filmed, anything offers that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I'm doing the cartoon Trolls for Netflix.
Oh, really?
That's ongoing, which is cool.
Yeah. I'm doing a TV show called Best Intentions, shooting in Canada in March.
Okay, yeah. Well, what's that going to be on?
It's on Pop TV in the States.
Right.
So I got it via the US side of things.
Yeah.
But it will be on Sky or something here, I would imagine. Yeah.
I love the way you said Sky or something.
I don't know.
It's crazy.
Just, you know how it goes.
Hello, one of those little channels, you know. Anyone heard of them?
BB something.
No, sir. They've gone years ago.
What about yourself, Sophie? Anything coming up?
It's quite quiet at the moment, but there's a couple of meetings that I've got lined up. But I am hopefully doing a small transition. I'm going to LA, and lovely David here has actually given me some really, really good advice about that. So that's my next little adventure.
Oh, yeah. Well, good luck.
So if it all goes wrong, I'll blame him. He didn't even hear me.
And if it all goes well.
If it all goes wrong, I know it's your fault, yeah?
I'll sort it out.
Oh, and what happens if it goes really badly? Who are you going to, you know, then. If it goes really badly, you're going to have to blame him twice.
Yeah, exactly.
There if it go. Goes well, then you've got a pint coming your way.
Yeah.
And Jenny, what are you doing these days? Yeah. Obviously, you know.
What have I got coming up? Another convention, perhaps, on the Isle of Wight?
Fingers crossed, eh? It's less travel.
No, I gave it up in 1992. And I gave it up, if it might be interesting, I don't know, saying David, to David, I don't know if you were interested.
Oh, I was, of course I was.
No, I had a dream, actually, in 1991, and the dream was that the proscenium arch, you know, the thing around the theatre, was getting lower and lower onto my head, and the stems of the proscenium arch were going into the mud. So I thought, okay. Then in front of me, there was a lot of muddy water. And beyond that were a lot of people waving at me. And they were not very well. They got a lot of bandages on. So I thought, okay, there is a message here. And it was very clear. And it was like, the time has come when you stop it. And so it took me 2 years, actually, to get out of the way of being an actress. Because you just, it's an experience you have to go through. Because you're somebody else, and then you're not. You've got to learn to be yourself. You've got to learn to be yourself again. So that was a good experience. Then I took up holistic work and alternative medicine and stuff like that, which I did for the next 19 years. So I haven't got now. I'm not doing anything. I'm just being on the Isle of Wight. And my friend said to me, oh, how many bees have you got?
Did you say that the bees are a naturally occurring thing? You don't own them all.
Yeah.
It's not like so not like swans or anything owning to the queen or anything.
It's so good, isn't it?
That's wonderful. Bees? Yeah. Well, have we got any questions for our panel here before we wrap up? It looks like no, and I'm out of questions too. So therefore, we will say once again, thank you very much to Jenny, to David,
thank you.
And to V, our Doctor Who panel number two. Oh, there thank you go. You. That's the end of that. Hello, you two. Should we come and sit over there with you? It might be a bit cosier if we do that. Well, now it's for the writers' panel, part two. So if you could both really energetically and making as much noise as you can, welcome to my stage, Andrew Smith. We've got Simon Buster-Jones and Robert Shearman, writers for Doctor Who. Here they come. That's brilliant. I love that. That's good though, isn't it? You could have gone through. It would have been fine. Grab yourselves a microphone. Although, as we just said, not necessarily necessary. Necessarily necessary.
There you go. There you go.
So we have the three of you here yet again. Thanks for coming. How are you finding FantasyCon? How is it? What have you been up to? How's the last day and a half been?
They've been all right. We sit out there and people come and say hello, and we're grateful that people know who we are, really.
If they know who we are, then we're grateful.
Yeah, sometimes they have no idea who we are, and then we get very, very angry.
Just start throwing things around.
There have been a few fist fights, but it's been all right, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's just been me and you.
It's been you and me. Yeah. It's been okay.
And it's good. It's been really good to be on the Isle of Wight for the first time for me as well.
Yeah, well, that is.
I live here.
Do you? I didn't know that. Right. What, whereabouts? No, don't tell me. So you're all writers for Doctor Who. How did you get into it? If we go along the line and explain how you all got into your writing for Doctor Who. And
well, for me, I was back in the late 70s and into 1980. I'd been writing, well, as long as I can remember, really. But wanted to be a writer for TV, and I submitted ideas to Doctor Who and to other programs. At the time, I was writing comedy for radio, for Weekending on Radio 4 from 79. Doctor Who, I'd been sending ideas in to script editors, so Robert Holmes, Anthony Reed, and Douglas Adams, and getting some encouraging replies. And then an idea that I sent to Douglas, Chris said he wanted to talk to me about it. He said I couldn't write for the show because I lived too far away in Glasgow, but then I came down to London, walked in the office, and straight away he said they wanted to commission me to write episode one of what became Full Circle, and see what they thought of it. So I did that, sent it in, and a week later got the phone call that they wanted the other three, that they really liked that episode, and yeah, it went from there.
Okay.
Yeah, in my case, I was a comedy writer for theatre mostly, and moved into doing things for BBC Radio around the time that Big Finish started. And Nick Pegg, who I've been at university with, who was directing some of the early Big Finishes, told Gary Russell that a Doctor Who fan he knew was a radio writer. So I got commissioned to write a shape-shifting penguin story for Tom Baker, which became Colin Baker when Tom said, yeah, I don't think I want to do that, thanks. And because of that, I got the phone call from Russell T. Davies asking to be on the first series of the revived series. So when that came back a few years later. So that was, yeah, so I mean, I've just been a working writer for maybe the last 15 years before I got the call to do Doctor Who, which was great because I was a, you know, childhood fan. And so, yeah, so that was my way in. It was a fairly traditional route, to be honest, but yeah.
And it worked for you, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you were charged with bringing back the Daleks, weren't you? Well,
I was, yeah. It was very odd because I just had a meeting with my agent who was Australian. And I'd said to her, rather sniffily, that I would no longer work on any television show which I couldn't have a hand in trying to run. And she'd sort of listened to me and thought, yeah, but you're not able to do that. But she said, she listened and said, okay, so we'll turn down all TV work that you're not going to run. And then I got a phone call from her one day, and I was on a bus in London. She said, yeah, we had this offer. Obviously, we've said no. But it was to do a show called Doctor Who. And I said, right? And she said, and yeah, it's to do, I don't know, I mean, I said, so this is what, it's a straight offer. I mean, they're not even having a meeting. They want you to do episode 6 of this new series and bring back a monster called, hang on, I've got it written down, something like a Dalek. And I said, right, well, call them back. She said, well, no, it's closed now. And I said, no, don't call them back. Call them back now and just say yes. And I was on this, as I say, on a bus. I wasn't going to tell anybody. And I was kind of dancing a bit in the aisles, which was a dangerous thing to do on a London bus. It was terrific. I mean, it was very unexpected because I wasn't really, I feel, at a level of TV writing where I would get that phone call at all. So I was terribly, terribly excited.
Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. Simon, what about yourself? How did you get into The Who?
I certainly wasn't, because I've never had that phone call. Anyway, I've always written since I was quite young. I've always liked reading and writing. I've always liked Doctor Who. I've always written stories of my own. I was a civil servant, full-time civil servant, working for the Home Office around about 1994-ish, and Doctor Who Monthly, which I was reading every month because I was a Doctor Who fan, had a Drabble Who competition to write 50-word short stories for a charity collection that David Howe was going to put together. And they were going to have a competition, and the best two from the competition were going to get in the book. So I did one of those, got in the book. Well, I didn't win, but I did get in the book. And emboldened by that, I wrote to Virgin, who were publishing the New Adventures at the time, with what was the proposal for my first novel, The Death of Art, set in Paris with subatomic aliens and psychic powers and lots of running around and too complicated for words. And why has he written all this? And can't he write something simple? Anyway, even though it was too complicated, they still published it. And since then, published other things of mine. So I'm very happy, at least as far as that's gone. And I've really loved it. And it's been a pleasure.
So when it comes to your stories, is there a different process to writing for audio to television, audio to visual?
Yeah, I mean, well, for that very, very reason. I mean, with audio is more like theatre. It's much more dialogue-based. It's more about the ambiguity, actually. It's about playing the game with the audience that they can't see what you're doing. And rather than that being embarrassing, making that a strength. I mean, making that part of the game that you're sort of misleading them for fun. Whereas TV is hugely visual. I mean, it's really trying to write a movie. And my problem doing TV was always, because my theatre background, I like writing dialogue. So my first TV efforts were just too wordy, because I never understood that actually a gesture is often enough. By the time I did Doctor Who, I'd learned it better. But, you know, but what you wanted with Dalek was just lots of big visual moments. So, yeah, I mean, hugely different.
I suppose it must be a longer process than writing for audio. Sorry, writing for television. No, writing for audio than television, because obviously you've got so much more you've got to get into it. And as you say, the words have got to do the describing that the gestures can do.
And how long did Full Circle take you, Andy? It was...
Well, I was commissioned for Full Circle initially in February 1980. We recorded it in July. I think we had the shooting script done by May. So, yeah, and there was that thing, again, I did episode one, and I'm pretty sure I did scene breakdowns as well, which are between the storyline and the script stage. You get a scene breakdown, so just brief descriptions of each scene and how they fit, so you get an idea of the tempo as well. But it's what you also have with television, of course, is you have a lot more creative inputs into the finished products. You've got designers and costume, makeup. It's never quite like you think it is in your head. Particularly something like Doctor Who, where you're creating alien worlds and monsters or whatever. I mean, the Marshmen in Full Circle are not at all what I thought they'd look like, for example. But then again, it's not simply about realizing your creative vision. It is a very collaborative process. And for Full Circle, in particular, I was very lucky that Peter Grimwade as director and Max Sammet as the film cameraman. It did just a brilliant job. But with audio, it's probably closer to, there are fewer, I nearly used the word interference there, but there are fewer people creating that final product, so it will tend to be closer to what you've got in your head, I suppose.
In audio, it takes me about a week to write a script. With Dalek, it took me 9 months. So that I wrote about 13 drafts of it. Because what I forget, is that it's expensive, which means that there's going to be more and more people coming in every draft saying, we really want our money's worth. So there's more and more, what I would think of as interference, what they would regard as helpful notes. So there's always another draft.
Well, that was going to be my next question, actually. When you're writing something and you've got a grand idea for a planet or a location for a story, you visualise it in one way, clearly, as you're writing it. How close does it come to what you're visualising to actually sometimes what you see on the screen, obviously? You can't do it as you can, Yeah.
Pretty close for Dalek, actually. I mean, we filmed Dalek in a car park, mostly, in the underground car park of the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff. And because I knew I was writing the whole thing underground in a sort of base, I thought they'll probably use a car park. and also because at that stage we knew that they were used finding Cardiff locations. It was pretty much what I had in mind. I kept being told by the early script stuff to try and be more expensive. Because I knew I was a Doctor Who fan, and because in my head I always thought, yeah, I'm going to do the one which has no location work. In my head I was imagining those 1980s days of just doing everything on studio sets. So they kept on saying, you can spend more money, And I'd say, really? All right. I put in some special effects. So yeah, it wasn't far away for me. But I mean, because you had Black Park as well, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a great location. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it was a while ago now, so it's difficult to remember exactly what was in my head. I do remember that. I mean, the Marshmen, as I said, looked different. I thought, but that still happened. I was talking to Stephen Greenhorn about this, and he said the same thing with the hat, and the Doctor's daughter again did not look anything at all like he had in his head. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. Yeah. With audio, painting the picture on audio is a thing of just not being too descriptive, and actually allowing the audience to kind of fill the gap at times. And we have rules as well. I mean, there is a strict rule now at Big Finish about people talking to themselves, which, again, you know, we try to avoid. But, yeah, just giving some of the details, but just letting people, you know, as I say, fill in some of the gaps themselves is quite a nice trick on audio.
When you're writing for television, we've discussed budgets briefly. Do you write with a budget in mind, or do you think, well, we could make this massively extravagant if we've got £50 billion to throw at this, or are you thinking, well, we're more than likely going to be filming in a shed?
I was being cheap. I kept on, because it's Doctor Who, and I'm a Doctor Who fan, I kept on thinking, I must be cheap, which they were quite offended by. You know, I'd go for early meetings and they'd say, you know, we aren't, it's not an amateur production. I'd say,
have you seen the classic stuff, you could say?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly, because that's what I was brought up on.
Exactly, yeah.
But they would keep on stressing, you know, for God's sake, this is going to be a really big landmark new series. Could you try and make it look expensive? And I said, all right. I mean, they got, as I say, genuinely irritable about it. So, but normally, yeah, I mean, you try and accommodate the people you're working for. So you don't want to be stupid and suddenly throw in tons of characters have only got one line to say, because that's very expensive. So, yeah.
Yeah, back in the day, I mean, in some ways you don't always know what things cost, but there were some rules. I mean, back in the day, studio-based stories like Full Circle, with multiple cameras, one thing was be careful of the number of sets. That's a real restriction. Something like Full Circle, you wouldn't want more than 7 or 8 studio sets, and you also wouldn't. In that sort of system as well, you don't write a script, but you shouldn't write a script where you've got a set that turns up for one scene and then isn't used again. And I actually accidentally did that. I had a scene with Logan that was actually with him being offered the job that in the finished series is in the Great Book Room, but in the very first draft script, that was in his quarters in the Starliner. But other scenes that I planned for it, I took out, so that finished up the only scene there. So quite rightly, as I did, well, we, you know, we don't want to build a set for that one scene, so we'll have it in the Great Book Room. But yeah, there were quite strict limitations on the number of sets. And I think now where things are more location based, you can more easily get that, a story where, again, you're in one location for one scene and move on, and that helps the storytelling.
You end up feeling so guilty. I mean, I went on set for Dalek and I spent all the time I was watching it being made feeling terribly guilty, because it takes forever. And it's incredibly boring. You know, a single scene that lasts a minute on screen will take 30, 40 takes. And every time that they do it again, you think, it's because my dialogue is terrible. And you think it's always because of you. So I went home.
And that doesn't change. Again back in the early 80s, again, it surprised me being, because I was there for all of it, and the time it took to do everything. There was a lot of setting up. And I remember, I'd wanted to be an actor at one point. I remember thinking, I'm glad I didn't really, because that job involves a hell of a lot of just sitting around waiting for things to happen. Especially, I mean, I remember Tony Calvin, who in particular, for some reason, sitting around doing his crossword and whatever, just waiting to be called to do something. And maybe the idea of being paid to sit around sounds good, but it looked really tedious. So I was glad I had the job that I did.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap up shortly, because we're being kicked off at 1 o'clock, because there's some entertainment on the way, apparently. Some singing. Not me. No, not me. But before I let
you
go,
Rob,
could you all let me know your favourite character that you've created in your writing? Doctor Who, or otherwise? I mean, I could have given you that yesterday to think about, but no, I'll spring it on you now.
I'll chip in quickly with that, and that's on audio for Survivors for Big Finish. Season 5, I wrote 2 episodes of that, and there's a character, Carol Baker, played by Niamh McIntosh from television's Doctor Who. And she's a character, if you know survivors, people have been wiped out by a disease. In this box set, the disease came back and she was kind of a typhoid Mary carrying the disease. And she's basically a nice person who makes some really bad decisions and finishes up causing a lot of deaths. And a combination of what was on the page and what Niamh did with it makes that very definitely my favourite character.
I know that everyone's favourite Doctor Who companion is probably Adam Mitchell from Dalek. I mean, everybody adored him. So I'm very proud that I created him because I know it's made a lot of people's lives better to see him on screen.
Is he honestly more popular than Adric?
It's about equivalent, isn't it? He wasn't on as long as Adric. Yeah. So yeah, I'm quite proud of Adam actually, because Adam is hated. I mean, Adam's really hated, and I quite like that because actually Adam is me. I vote him to be me, so I take it very very personally.
Okay, lovely. And finally, Simon.
Well, difficult. Novels are quite different, I think, from TV because you don't have to deal with actors. You do have to deal with editors, and you have to deal with the reader's imagination, and readers imagine characters quite differently from how you think you've written them quite often. So I'm going to go for something that isn't really a character, sort of, or sort of is, depending how you look at it. Tiny bit of background, I know we're in a hurry.
No, we've got 5 minutes, it's fine.
Okay. The great time war on screen is against the Daleks. The time war that was going on in the books, in the Eighth Doctor Adventures, wasn't resolved there, but sort of spun off into another thing using the characters Lawrence Miles had developed, called Faction Paradox. And there, that war, the Great War in Heaven, is still going on, although I think there is a book now that resolves it, not by me. But it was going on for quite a while. But there was always a big question over who the enemy was, who the great thing was that could oppose the Time Lords. And we eventually ended up with a collection I'm quite proud of, edited by me, called The Book of the Enemy, in which every author had, with some ground rules set, their own chance to develop what the enemy was and what it was going to be like. And then I came up and tied them all together, and I liked my solution of tying them together. So my character is the enemy. And if you want to know who the enemy is in that book, you'll have to buy a copy from me. So there you are. That's my advertisement for the day.
Nice bit of plugging as well. That's very good. Boys, thank you very much. Andrew, Simon, Robert, lovely to talk to you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast is an APV Services production, sponsored by whowon.co.uk and lavazi.co.uk. We are a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. Doctor Who is a trademark of the British Broadcasting Corporation. No copyright infringement intended.